brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Going to be talking about pensions. Pensions, yes, pensions. Those things that workers used to have, you know, at least my grandparents' generation used to have before corporate America decided, hey, have this wonderful, this mythical, magical, this wonderful 401k. It's got a K. Who could be happier with something that has a K in it? K, kind of. I guess I don't know what I can say on that. A big pile of steaming you-know-what is what they've turned into. Because they haven't led to the security. They haven't led to the retirement that, well, we were promised. And I go back to myself. I remember, oh, Rick, you have $1 million. You work here 30 years. Yeah, never going to happen. But we're going to talk about that. Also, food stamps, you know, as the Republicans pursue austerity, as we go, oh, screw those people. Let them starve. We'll talk about the state's policy on the needy. Also, another false choice. Jobs or profit? You make the choice. Should we have jobs or should we have profit? Should we breathe or should we have jobs? You make the choice. Also going to talk about the big question. Can professional sports, can they survive in the free market? Is it something that the free market could support, or do they absolutely have to have taxpayer dollars? Is it something that we have to continually feed the beast as we build them bigger and bigger monstrosities of stadiums with, of course, lots of skyboxes, lots of amenities for the very well-to-do, and, of course, lots of concession and parking money for the owners? Can it survive? That'll be the question. I'm also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. But on the pension front, this is going to be one of those really very telling weeks as things go through the Pennsylvania legislature. What's going to happen with state workers, with teachers, with cops and firefighters? What's going to happen to their pensions? If you look at, and as I've been watching this whole thing develop, and we've been trying to talk about it over the last several months, and for me, I have a very simple view of this. The pension system that we have for cops and firefighters and teachers and state workers and the people who do all of the work that we depend on is something that's there for not only the good of their retirement, but the good of society. Because I'm a firm believer in government lifting us up, not tearing us down. So the policies that we set forth as a society through our government, what we the people say is the right thing to do in the economy, the right thing to do in our neighborhoods, in our states, should be something that lifts the private sector up to meet. If you want to attract the best and brightest, and this is what the right wing loves to say, well, those state workers, they should make less because evidently they're not the best and brightest. Yet if you look at the facts that, here on the state level, those are generally people who have higher advanced degrees, people who in the private sector would make much more money. And we have enticed them over the years with security. Because I think most people want that security. Most people want security in old age. So you look at union contracts across the country. Most people vote for increases in their pension, increase in their retiree health care, increase in their health care spending, and not so much maybe in their paychecks. I mean, that's borne out across divides. People want to have that security. And what's going on is the Republicans are right before our very eyes doing what the private sector has done for the last 20, 30 years, which is to rip that security out from under not just their workers, but society as a whole. And creating this environment where, it's dog eat dog, man. And if your pension's got thrown away, so be it. And I've been watching some of the news reports on this and some of the statements that are being made. And, for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about this Tea Party think tank, the Commonwealth Foundation. who funded, you know, if we knew exactly who funded, we assume that it's the same right-wing characters, the Koch brothers, the billionaire class, the Tolls, the Toll groups, those people who've been spending billions of dollars over the years to push their agenda, to push their message, to push their vision of what this country should be, which is, well, they're taking all of the cookies and us fighting over that last crumb. And what they see this pension situation as here in the state, you're talking a large amount of money in the state system. They want to put that on Wall Street so they can fee us to death so that they can profit from it and then pull out that security out from under all of those workers. And they're doing it by using the worst in us. And I've talked to so many people who've said, well, you know, they stole my pension. Why shouldn't we steal theirs? And I've heard that so many times that, well, you know, my pension was destroyed. And I'm going, but does that make it right? I mean, when I grew up as a kid, you know, my mother did instill in me this idea of right and wrong. Not the idea of what's expedient, what's possible, what's happening. And, you know, there's part of me that's pragmatic, said, well, you know, it's the direction the country's going. Everybody else got screwed, so they should too. But going back to, you know, my mother, you know, right and wrong. This is wrong. Flat wrong. What this governor, what these Republicans are trying to do, a large number of them, and maybe a couple of Democrats, we don't know yet because the votes haven't been tallied, haven't been taken. But what this tells me is there are people who fundamentally don't believe in right and wrong. They believe in what they can get away with. And I look at this whole argument, this whole another created crisis, understand that. This crisis was created out of defunding the pension system as they've been doing for almost a generation now. And, of course, let's not forget the Bush collapse of Wall Street that basically made my 401k a 200.5 and hit every retirement, every pension fund in this country, especially the state ones. But I look at this Commonwealth Foundation, and this is where there were a couple of comments in an article I read recently that caught my attention. And one of them had to do with this idea that the right wing is pushing that, you know, we just can't have a public pension system because the politicians, they overpromise stuff. You know, they make grandiose promises that they're never going to be able to keep, and then they underfund them. So that they create this crisis down the road. And there's something to that. And for me, it's been pushed solely by those on the right, because you do have politicians on both sides who want to say, you know what, we don't want to raise taxes if we don't have to. And we need to attract the best and brightest. And we can't do it because we can't raise taxes to give wage increases. So we're going to give pension security. And nobody expected, well, I think we all expected what happened in 2008 to happen because of the loosening of, well, the destruction of regulation and that ending of the dividing line between banking and gambling. But that's a whole other argument. But I see this right-wing push by these shills for the extremists who say, well, you know, it happened, too bad, we have to deal with it, and we're going to deal with it off the backs of those who are, well, really not able to fight for themselves. I mean, because they're begging for the teachers and the firefighters, and we're going to be talking to people over the next couple of weeks who they're going to get their pension stolen if things go the way I see it. The right wing is just waiting for that teacher to come out and say, oh, see, greedy teacher just wants for herself or himself. Uh-uh. It's the difference between right and wrong. And the other view that the right is taking is they're trying to provide a scenario that pits the private sector with the public sector. And they're completely different. The private sector has already killed defined benefit pension plans, and they've done it through a whole bunch of shenanigans and a whole bunch of gaming where they would sell off subsidiaries of companies, load them with all of the pension obligations, load them up with a massive amount of debt, run them through bankruptcy court and write all of that stuff away. And they've been getting away with it because you and me and people who work for a living, they know they could screw because you know how many people had a voice? How many people were seeing the organizing that would go into this? So they're trying to, and my assumption is they're trying to do kind of the same thing, only in the public sector. They've created this massive crisis. And they keep throwing out numbers, $41 billion. And I saw one report that said $44 billion. I've seen another that says $47. And they keep changing the numbers around. And look, it's that whole lie to me with the facts. It's the whole use numbers and actuarial tables to create the scenario that you want. So if you're looking for a huge number, if you're like the Tea Party think tank, you're gonna lower your assessments, and you're gonna get a bigger number that comes out of the other end. We're talking over a generation though, and the way that they're framing this, and the moneyed interest. This would be a huge win if you see the state of Pennsylvania's pension plan, if you see the state employees' retirement system and the public school employees' retirement system. If you see the two of those turn to 401ks, see them turn to Wall Street, be a huge, huge win for the wealth class. Because now they've really got that desperation class that they've been looking for. Because the next time they crash the economy, it's not their money. It's other people's money. It's those pension funds. And those people who depended on these pensions, well, you're on your own, brother. It's the free market. And it sounds good, doesn't it? Free market. You have to make your own choices. Well, look at what it's gotten. Look what it's gotten most of the working public. And I read something not too long ago. Said the average 401k in this country, the average 401k is about $18,000. And you go, really? $18,000? That's it? How many people could retire on that much? Yeah, I see numbers. You need $1 million to retire at a reasonable level. For me, I would rather see a pension system set up much like Social Security. Let me buy more into Social Security. Let me buy more into Medicare. Because they're operated right. The problem is you've got people who are defunding them, creating these crises. And this is where I go back to the Tea Party think tank saying the truth. Truth is they support politicians who overpromise. They support politicians who will not put the resource towards funding those, and then they support politicians who turn around and say, well, see, it didn't work, because we don't believe government can work, because we've created a situation where we've given too much, we haven't raised the revenue to get it, and now we turn around and say, see, it didn't work, we told you it wasn't going to work, because the plan that they pushed forth is the one that destroyed it. And heads they win, tails they win. Because it's all about destroying what we, the people, have built. Simple stuff. Let's take a quick break and come back, talk a little bit more about this pension situation with our good friend Dr. Stephen Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. Get the real skinny, the real facts, thoughts on what's going on. Your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Quick break, right back after this. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Hundreds of workers gathered on the green in New Haven, Connecticut on May Day for a statewide celebration of workers' victories and a call for more protections as well as immigration reform. Melinda Tuhus was there.
The event, organized by the Connecticut AFL-CIO and pro-immigrant grassroots groups, drew members of more than a dozen unions and their supporters. The theme was "The Time Is Now." Every speech was punctuated by lively Mexican cumbia music. Next up was Governor Daniel Malloy, who noted some recent labor successes in the state.
We are the first state and the only state to have paid sick leave.
The law went into effect last year with strong support from the governor to get it passed. It provides service and retail workers of companies with 50 or more employees with 1 hour of sick time for every 40 hours that employee works. Malloy also touted the immigrant-friendly steps the state has taken, such as the DREAM Act allowing undocumented students to pay in-state college tuition rates and the current effort to allow undocumented residents to get driver's licenses. And back in 2007, New Haven created the first municipal resident ID card in the nation that was available regardless of immigration status, a card that's now carried by thousands of immigrants and citizens alike. Malloy concluded,
"We have another fight this year to win at the legislature, and that is to raise the minimum wage."
He supports raising the minimum wage to $9 an hour from its current $8.25, which is tied for fourth highest in the nation. Connecticut is a high cost of living state, and right now a person working full-time for minimum wage makes an annual salary of $16,500. Another speaker was Mark Ehrlich, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the New England Regional Council of Carpenters. He said immigrant workers from Central America, South America, and Eastern Europe have swelled the ranks of the construction workforce and transformed his industry.
"It is a system designed to profit unscrupulous employers, to exploit immigrant workers, and to undermine standards for all of us who work in construction."
Connecticut is home to almost 250,000 union members, a number that has declined steadily in recent years, including an almost 3 percentage point drop from 2011 to 2012, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Rallygoers hope to reverse that trend. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And I think it's going to be an awakening to us, because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education like better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Oh, yes, what a wonderful world indeed. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Interested in your thoughts on this pension situation. You know, I look at an interesting little factoid I came across from the Sloan Center on Aging and Work at Boston College. This is one of those groups that's funded by, you know, big auto groups and big drug companies. But they point out that retirement participation plans with auto enrollment is 10% higher than plans without auto enrollment. In fact, they're saying that worker participation, when it's voluntary, when they have to sign up, about 67% compared to 77%. When people are automatically enrolled. And, you know, when I saw the automatic enrollment number, I thought it would be much higher, because that tells me that, you know, almost 23, just about 23% of the people opt out of them. And you have to then go, you know, how little or, you know, what's the scenario around that? Because, you know, most people I know, you know, it just comes out, and it's one of those things that's automatic, which is why I think Social Security is the right way to go. It's something that's just taken out. You don't miss it. It's in there. And you're going to have some security at the end of it, which, you know, I think is the right way to go. We're working on trying to get a hold of Dr. Stephen Herzenberg to give us some updates on what's going on the legislature. But, you know, this pension situation, and I'll tell you, from my point of view, the plans that I've seen, the discussions that I've seen around this idea that they're going to change from a defined benefit plan to a defined contribution plan, is curious, because even the experts that, you know, the Tea Party think tank brought in for the Republicans, because, you know, right now the GOP is run by the moneyed interests, and the moneyed interests are funding this Tea Party think tank, who's pushing their agenda. So basically what comes out of the Tea Party think tank is what ends up in the hands of the Republican legislature. But even their experts say, okay, we're going to go from this defined benefit plan that does provide security for the worker, security for society, because there's money in the economy, and is not a bad deal. Had you done it right, had you not defunded it, and of course, had you not had the massive collapse due to bad policy back in 2008, probably wouldn't have been as horrible. But they all agree that, you know, if you go to this defined contribution plan and you move from the defined benefit, it's going to cost us more. And to me, that just seems kind of dumb, other than it's about ideology. And they say that, well, we're doing it because it's the right thing to do, because it's our ideology, not because it's good for the taxpayer, not because it's good for the bottom line, because it's our it's our belief. So as I'm seeing this, and maybe Dr. Herzenberg will have a more insight on this than I do, it seems dumb to me to move from a plan that adds security and a safety net for society and this workforce into a gambling one that's going to cost us more and provide less of security for society. It just seems dumb to me, which is why I've got Dr. Steven Herzenberg, Executive Director of the Keystone Research Center, on the line. Steve, thanks for taking time for me.
My pleasure, Rick. Good to be here.
So I'm looking at this pension idea, and moving from this defined benefit plan, which in my view, and you can help me if I'm wrong, provides, you know, security for the worker in their old age, and so security for society, and there's going to be money going into the economy. Moving from that to a defined contribution plan, which who knows where the hell it goes, seems dumb. But then add on to it, it's going to cost more. That seems even dumber to me.
No, I think you're on target. Yeah, the plan that the governor is expected to formally introduce his legislation tomorrow is a bad deal for taxpayers as well as for middle-class public sector, you know, workers. So dumb seems like a fairly concise summary.
Although, I mean, at the end of it, it comes down to the ideology of the people at the Tea Party think tank, which is, you know, the reports that I've seen, the plans that they've been throwing out there. You've got all of these people from this well-funded think tank throwing out these numbers. Wow, I think it was 47 is the latest, 47.4 billion unfunded liability now they're throwing around. How accurate is that?
I mean, in terms of the long-term debt that the pension funds need, you know, 30 years down the road, 40 years down the road, to meet the current obligations, that's accurate. But, again, it's a big distortion because, I mean, the good news is the pension plans both have plenty of money now, this year, next year, 10 years now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, to pay all of the obligations they have. Yes, there's a debt because A, the politicians did something Corbett wants to do again, which is they didn't put money into the pension plan for the last 12 years the way they should have. You know, a pension is a cost of doing business. So if you don't put anything in, some years they didn't put anything in, then you know, over a period of time, you're going to accumulate a debt. And so you're going to have to deal with that. And then the second thing that did happen is, you know, we had a market downturn in the early 2000s. We had an even deeper market downturn from kind of 2007, the end of the second George W. Bush term, through about 2009 was when the market started to go up again under Obama. So, you know, we had a set of circumstances that led to that debt. But, I mean, this is from the perspective of the facts here, you're right, it's ideology. Because if your real concern was the taxpayer, you wouldn't cut off your nose to spite your face, right? You wouldn't, because of this debt that's already been accumulated, you wouldn't respond to that concern by going with a more expensive pension plan that's going to hurt workers and cost taxpayers. So, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense, and you know it is driven by a combination of ideology and the fact that a lot of financial firms wouldn't mind investing public sector workers' money. That's more profits for them at the expense of middle class workers. So it's ideology and the financial self-interest of Wall Street are the main things driving this push.
Right. Well, what do you say to the person who argues that, this shouldn't be in the hands of the public sector because of what you said? You've got politicians who aren't going, you've got Tom Corbett who's not going to fund it. You've got a legislature who has no appetite for putting the contribution in because it would mean maybe having to raise a little revenue from somewhere else. And you've got people who look, quite frankly and quite candidly, they have this view that we starve the beast and just systematically destroy things. So what do you say to the person who says it shouldn't be in their hands because of that situation?
Again, to me, it's like there's a medical term, right? Doctors first do no harm. So it's the same situation here that sure, you've got a set of practical challenges. Politicians made some mistakes in the past. So you want to address that. Now, the good news is lots of states have addressed that with defined benefit plans. So if there are certain mistakes, like not putting in enough money every year, that can get you into trouble with any pension plan, but certainly with a defined benefit plan, then, you need a rule that says you got to put in enough money every year. It's really not that complicated. We actually did a lot of things in 2010. The legislature in the Pension Reform Act of 2010 did, first of all, it cut benefits for public employees going forward. Second, they put in place this unique provision that Pennsylvania has, and I'm not sure any other state has it, which is if financial markets turn down again in the future, then they can get another 2% of salary contribution from employees. It's called a risk-sharing premium. So if the market turns down, it's not just taxpayers. It's also workers that are on the hook to fill the hole. As long as workers' contributions only go up if the market turns down, if the state and schools also maintain or increase their contributions, that's actually smart. It's insurance against short-sighted political behavior in the future. So I think we've now got a situation where the kind of short-sighted behavior that took place in the past 12 years is much less likely. We've taken the steps, and switching to a defined contribution plan because it hurts taxpayers and it hurts the middle class is a cure that's worse than the disease. It does harm, which is, again, whether you're a doctor or a policymaker, first, do no harm is a pretty good principle. The governor's proposal violates that principle.
Yeah, but you said, that things are moving in place to where you won't do some of the things that they did in the past, but yet Governor Corbett they're talking about not funding it again this year.
Yeah, they are. Now, again, the provision that provides incentive for the state not to cut contributions is a provision that applies if the market goes south. Of course, the market's roaring away right now, right? So, again, hopefully the legislature will have the wisdom to not allow Governor Corbett to repeat the mistakes of the last dozen years and divert pension contributions to other purposes, yet again. We'll have to see what happens in the next couple months.
Well, let me ask you, in your expert opinion as an economist and looking at Act 120 and some of the performance that we've seen the last 2 years, is this sufficient? I mean, in going forward, is this going to help solve some of the problems?
It would help if we had some other policies. The biggest thing is Pennsylvania has a revenue problem, right? We don't have we keep cutting corporate taxes. Right now there's a debate about cutting corporate taxes yet again. They're claiming that they're going to do something about some of the corporate tax loopholes where, as you know, and many people in your audience know, we've got a Swiss cheese corporate tax law in Pennsylvania. So we've got on the books a pretty high corporate net income tax of 9.99%. But a lot of the bigger corporations, they just set up another mailbox in Delaware, and they manipulate their books, and they end up getting away with paying an effective rate that's a lot less than 9.99%, and it sometimes is zero. And so, you know, what we've got is yet another corporate tax cut, which is all this hue and cry about this high tax rate, which a few companies, principal companies based just in Pennsylvania, so they don't have the flexibility to manipulate their books. So it's fine to lower that top corporate tax rate, but they're not really closing the loophole. So here in a situation where we can't fund education adequately, we still haven't funded our transportation infrastructure. We have a pension hole. We already have, in the first 2 years of recovery for which we have data, we have the top 1% taking home more than 100% of all the increase in income in this country. And so now you're going to cut corporate taxes in a way that won't actually create any jobs, because what's constraining jobs now is not the tax rate. It's the fact that companies still are nervous that there won't be customers if they open another store or build another factory. So, again, we have a revenue problem. So if we stopped giving away money for nothing to rich people, and if we started having, instead of so-called austerity, if we had folks in Washington and Harrisburg who weren't deliberately slowing down the economy, slowing down the recovery, then if we were growing more quickly, tax revenues would be growing more quickly, and that helps with pensions, it helps with education, it helps with infrastructure. I mean, that's the biggest thing. Be right. Sensible about pension funding in the future. We took a big step forward in that direction in 2010, but there are some other things we could do. And then let's grow the economy, and you can't cut your way to prosperity, right? And so, that's been the rhetoric, although, of course, I think the people who are pushing this austerity strategy, this cuts-only strategy, know full well that it's actually going to keep, many of them do anyway, that it's going to mean that slow recovery. It's going to mean unemployment at 7%, 7.5%, 8% for year after year. What does that mean? Well, that means that wages and incomes for regular folks never go up.
Right.
And that the rewards of economic growth continue to be horribly tilted towards the top.
Yeah, and for me, again, I go back to all of this talk about the pensions, all of this talk of privatizing the wine and spirit shops, the lottery, all of this diversion, all of this distraction away from what the governor said he was going to do, which was going to create jobs. It was going to be about jobs, jobs, jobs. And what we need is a transportation plan that's going to put people back, the construction industry back to work. Because for me, you get people back to work, you get, as you pointed out, you get revenue in. And for what I would like to see to solve our pension problems, I would like to see them open up the state pension fund to all workers and let everybody pay into the system and get more people into a secure, defined benefit plan.
Yeah, and California took a small step, not all the way to what you just said, but towards creating a state-managed pension plan where you get the efficiencies of a giant pool, where you get professional management, where you have the ability for private sector workers with not even a simple savings plan to become part of a well-managed saving plan. So you're exactly right. We should be doing that. Let me touch two bases before I go. And again, if you've got a break come up, you let me know.
No, hit me.
But, well, the first thing is on the jobs. And so, again, it is absolutely true that the governor's jobs performance has been miserable. I mean, there's a lot of caveats around the state economies generally do a bit better or a bit worse than the national economy. So clearly how well the national economy is managed is critical. It's not all up to the governor. There's some things about our state that the governor doesn't control. He doesn't control how diverse our economy is. Governor doesn't control, really whether we get job growth as he did in his first 18 months, or job shrinkage, as he may have recently, in the gas industry, in the shale industry, right? But the governor does have some impact. And basically, everything Corbett has done has taken the state's economy in the wrong direction. If you have a cuts-only approach to the state budget, That shrinks the economy, lays off 20,000 people from the K through 12 public school system. Those people don't spend. That has a ripple effect. You don't deal with the state's transportation infrastructure problem, which is a criminal failure of leadership in a situation where interest rates are incredibly low and construction companies need work. You can get a fantastic deal for the public dollar, but do you show the leadership? Do you spend that money? Do you get the economy going with very good value for money? No, you don't. Now, a third thing, Medicaid expansion, so the ability to expand health care for folks without it, and almost entirely, well, the first several years entirely on the federal dollar, costing the state nothing. In fact, benefiting the state because you'd get economic growth and you'd get revenue. And even, you know, the governor of Florida, the legislature, I don't think gave him what he wanted, but a number of Republican governors did get Medicaid expansion through, brought those federal dollars into their state, addressed their health care problem, and yes, increased spending, increased growth, increased tax revenues, but Governor Corbett hasn't done that. So, I mean, he's been crowing a lot about, well, more than 100,000 jobs, private sector jobs created since he came in. Well, I did a couple calculations last week. This is an exclusive
good,
for you.
Let me
finish this first.
The more jobs governor. He's the more jobs governor. Tell me how many more jobs.
So the first thing is we did a calculation of if the state economy had grown as fast as the national economy since he came in, we'd have more than 120,000 more jobs. I mean, he inherited an economy that was growing faster than the national economy. So he's crowing about 100,000 jobs when that's less than half the number of jobs that he should have created based on a conservative calculation. The second thing is, again, he keeps on talking about more than 100,000 private sector jobs. We looked at the calculation of the last 12 months for which you have data. You know how many thousands of jobs in the private sector he created in the last 12 months?
No,
1,000.
Really?
So, I mean, again, what he inherited an economy growing fast, sometimes through the partway through his first year, but through the first budget that cut public spending, particularly on education, over the course of the next 12 months, that ripples through the economy. You get the layoffs, you get the impact on the rest of the economy. So, you know, again, basically 15 months. Into his economy, you know, he's got, over 100,000 private sector jobs thanks to the fact that he couldn't kill the Rendell expansion, you know, immediately. It took him a little while. But then in the last 12 months, again, you got 1,000 private sector jobs.
Well, that's pathetic. And this is from the more jobs governor. And yeah. I guess, wouldn't this then, Steve, be a perfect explanation and a perfect example of austerity not working?
It would exactly be a perfect example of that. And we're not an exception. We are consistent with evidence from a lot of states. There's a group called the Roosevelt Institute that did some analysis some months back, which looked at all the states that became, I can never get this straight, red across the board, right? So Republican governor and both chambers of the legislature.
Right.
And so again, what they documented is that you had a consistent pattern of austerity, of cuts only, not investing in the future. And systematically those states, again, it's a variation on the national economy. The national economy as a whole is not recovering fast enough. But in virtually every single case, those states were taken on more water, you know, as they ride the wave of the national economy, right? They're taking on more water, sinking lower, while in other states where you had more common sense leadership, balanced approach to the state budget, some investment in the future, you know, those states were doing better, bailing effectively, and seeing somewhat better economic growth, faster recoveries. So in the end, I think, so that's one of two points that I think that it's really important to underscore is you are right. This is the slow jobs, no jobs increasingly, governor, much worse performance than the national economy. There's been more and more talk of that the last few weeks, and I think that's going to be a really, really important theme. You know, I still hope that I mean, people's lives are affected when unemployment in Pennsylvania stays close to 8%, well, as the national rates come down, I think, what was it, 7.5% was the latest number, or a bit below that, maybe?
7.5.
Okay. So that's the first thing. He's the jobs governor, so let's keep looking at that.
No, not just the jobs governor, the more jobs governor.
Yeah, well, okay, so let's keep
more than
on,
Wyoming.
Well, fine. If he wants that to be the metric, we got to keep talking about that. We got to keep focused on that. But the second thing that we need to do much better in this pension debate, because we haven't succeeded yet, is we have to communicate to people that this public sector pension proposal of the governor's that will be introduced tomorrow, or he'll have a press conference anyway, in the Capitol, which will announce the legislation is going to be introduced, whether that actually happens tomorrow or a little later. We have to explain to people that this is an attack on the middle class. I mean, in the end, that's what it is. They've managed to frame it all in terms of that pension debt that you talked about, that $47 billion now, and we need to keep trying to communicate to people that the real issue here is the private sector retirement security has already been horribly eroded.
Yep.
This is an attempt to begin to erode middle class retirement security, the one place where it still exists. It's a boon for Wall Street because they'll get a bunch more business to invest with high fees, and because of those high fees, people will get less retirement security for every dollar they or the taxpayer put in. It's all about leveling, down, and if they pull the public sector down, public sector wages are already significantly lower than private sector wages on average. The one thing that is good about public sector employment is that the benefits, including the pension benefits, are good and are much better than typical for many workers in the private sector.
No, no, not if Corbett gets his way.
Well, but if he gets, so yeah, that's right. It's all part of a national effort. Let's pull the public sector retirement security down to the very low level that exists in the private sector where retirement security is in tatters. That relieves any kind of pressure on the private sector to do better if they want to compete for workers. So, yeah, it's all of this part of this race to the bottom. You wonder after, except for the second half of the 1990s, we've had 35 years of increasing inequality and increasingly sharply in the last dozen years, money going not just to the top 10% or 20% or 5%, but to that top 1% and to tiny fractions of the top 1%.
Yep.
You scratch your head and think, this can't keep going on, right? But it is continuing to go on the policies, including this pension proposal, that are being pushed by the right wing, will get us more of the same. So anyway, we need to keep trying to explain to people that the battle to protect retirement security, the one place that it still exists for the public sector, for the one place that it still exists for the middle class, which is in the public sector. We need to win that defensive battle in the next 2 months.
Yep. Let me ask you that.
And then we have to open a new front, which is how to do much better for private sector workers. Sorry, go ahead.
I agree. Last question I've got for you. But looking at this, and most of the people that I've talked to, they've already gotten screwed out of their pensions in the private sector. They've been bankruptcied out of their pensions. They've had them destroyed, had all that happen. And there seems to be this view that, well, I got mine stolen. And it seems to be it's okay that they get theirs stolen. How do you change that
yeah,
that
not,
perception?
I actually there is a lot of talk about pension envy, and certainly the right wing tries to exploit that, tries to divide and conquer. You know, I've seen some polling recently, and I actually think people generally in the private sector, if they have any basic information, if they know that public sector workers, put a lot of their own money This is especially true in Pennsylvania with the state workers and with the school employees across the state putting a lot of their own money. Then private sector workers say, do they deserve their pension? Yes, they do. And there's actually a bunch of new polling that shows that younger workers see a defined benefit pension, a secure pension, as a real advantage, a reason they would take a job or a reason that they like the job they've got, because there are still a few jobs in the private sector that do have those defined benefit pensions. So I actually think that the emphasis on pension envy is partly the rhetoric of the other side, and we need to keep educating people about the realities, but that the middle class in the private sector, as well as in the public sector, knows it's under assault. Again, I think if we can be persistent about explaining to people why this attack on public sector pensions is an attack on the middle class, I think people will be receptive. And I think if we follow that up, I mean, you gotta have something to say to the people who have nothing in the private sector. If we follow that up with something like the California type proposal, where the state runs a pension or retirement plan for private sector workers when they don't have one through their own job, then we can make headway. It's gonna take time, and they've got lots of money, but. You know, in the end, we have people's interest in mind, and they don't. So
excellent
maybe we
point.
Can win.
Excellent point, Steve. Always great to talk with you. I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend, Dr. Stephen Herzenberg, Keystone Research Center. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Earth, sky.
Earth's oceans might be acidifying today faster than they did in the last 300 million years, according to research by an international team of scientists.
Scientists say that too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is changing ocean chemistry and endangering key parts of the marine food chain.
What's happening is that as more and more carbon dioxide is added to the atmosphere, the oceans act like a sponge to draw the excess CO2 from the air. Carbon dioxide and water bind together to create carbonic acid, the same stuff that's used to make soft drinks bubbly.
It's a change in ocean chemistry, an increased acidity that endangers some ocean plankton and makes it harder for creatures like corals and mollusks to build reefs and shells.
The paper authors reviewed hundreds of paleo-oceanographic studies and found evidence for only one period in the past 300 million years when the oceans changed as fast as today. That was about 56 million years ago, after a mysterious surge of carbon into the atmosphere.
But in the last 100 years, rising carbon dioxide from human activities has acidified the ocean at least 10 times faster than 56 million years ago, say the researchers.
Learn more about ocean acidification. Come to our website, earthsky.org, and search for it. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
We don't think of the bulk of all we do. It's full of pain and pity. Let's go for the loss, and then we'll say hooray.
Boy, that just blows my mind. The more jobs governor. We created 110,000 new jobs. Private sector, we created 110,000 new jobs. It was everywhere. The more jobs governor. And in the last year, 1,000. I mean, do you need any more information to say, you know, austerity just not working? When you pull money out of an economy, what do you think happens? 1,000. 1,000, that's it. The more jobs, Governor, 1,000. And if you remember my statement on it, I said, you know, okay, fine, maybe that number was the Marcellus Shale math. Where they were saying, oh, we created, you know, tens of thousands of jobs. And you find out that, you know, for every one job, they had like five people who applied and then were hired. And counted that one position as, well, five jobs because we hired five people. And granted, one quit and then, you know, they got fired. And then five people churned through this one. That's five. So I could see the Corbett administration using that kind of math. And maybe that was the scenario, but 1,000 jobs over the last 12 months. I'm sorry, I'm missing the more jobs governor talk. In fact, everything this guy has done, everything that these people who are running our state government have done, have proven them correct. Government doesn't work. It doesn't work when you've got idiots running it. When you've got ideologues, it just doesn't work. When you've got people who blind faith belief, oh, I believe if we take enough money out of the economy, it'll grow. Defund education and we put 50 kids into a class, they'll learn and they'll do better on the tests. Yes. If we take all the money out of it, it will just magically grow. It would be like, and I remember the movie, I don't know how many people saw the movie Idiocracy. It was basically a future, I think they could have done a much better job with it, but the idea was still that in the future we'll have attention spans of a gnat, where 2 seconds is too long. And we'll just be doing the dumbest things. And when they froze this guy, you know, from the 1990s or 2000s or whenever the movie was made, and they froze him, and in like 100 years or a couple hundred years down the road, he comes to. And he's now the smartest guy in the world. Back in his day, he was the most average person on the planet, dead smack in the middle. And that's the reason they froze him, kind of an experiment to see, you know, where he would be in a year. Except it lasted a couple hundred. Well, he comes back, and the one part that just kind of completely sticks with me, and it's one of those things I could see this administration, I could see the Corbett people, I could see them doing. I really could. They couldn't figure out why the crops kept dying, and they were taking like a sports drink, and they were watering the plants with sports drinks. Because they didn't believe water, but God. And so this guy who was in his day the most average person in the world, now the smartest guy on the planet, says, well, why don't you put water on the crops? And one of the guys looked at him, and I could see the Corbett administration with this reaction. So he's telling people, put water on your fields so that the plants will grow. And the one guy goes, you mean toilet water? You mean the stuff that's in toilets? Put that on our food? And I could really, I mean, honestly, I could see that those type of ideologues who are blinded by only what they're fed by the Tea Party think tanks and the very wealthy extremists who are pushing this ideology. I could just see that happening. What? You mean put money in education? Well, learn kids a little bit better? It'll give them more opportunities for some learning? That doesn't sound right to me. It's not what we're told by the think tanks. I mean, just from a complete common sense point of view, just help, come with me here for a second. Just from a very common sense point of view, if you stop putting money into the local economy, you say, okay, you know, we're no more unemployment, no more food stamps, no more any of this stuff. You take all that money out. We're going to cut teachers. We're going to cut their pay. We're going to cut their jobs. 20,000 education professionals out of work since Corbett took office. We're going to cut all that stuff out. Are we then surprised that those people are no longer spending money in the local economy and the local businesses close their doors? I mean, for me, what I would expect, and trust me, I've had these conversations with a number of small business people who I'm trying to get to go out in public and say, hey, we need investment in infrastructure so those construction workers can have jobs, and we need to pay them a prevailing wage so they'll come into my store and spend money so I can hire people. The damn tax break isn't helping me because I don't have enough revenue coming in to take advantage of the damn tax breaks. I wish small business people would wake up to that reality. Look, if you don't have revenue coming in, you're not paying taxes anyway. But we have this lack of common sense, kind of, that we seem to think we could take money out of the economy. And the IMF, they had their study. Said, well, if I take a dollar out of the economy, it's only going to cost the economy 50 cents in reverberation. Yet we find out that by taking a dollar out of the economy, and this is what Europe has shown us, for taking every $1 out, it takes 250 out in reverberation. Think about that for a second. Every bit of that government investment, all of that stimulus that we should have been spending on roads and bridges and all that stuff that would stay in the local economy, not there. It's not there. So you don't have that reverberation effect. You don't have that snowball, that growth. What you've got is you've got shrinking. And what happens when things shrink? They continue to shrink. When you cut off oxygen to your brain, guess what happens? You die. And it's much like our economy. You cut off the lifeblood of any economy, which is disposable income, through rising wages and government spending. You kill the economy, which is what this governor and what this ideological party has done to our nation. Quick break, right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Hundreds of workers gathered on the green in New Haven, Connecticut on May Day for a statewide celebration of workers' victories and a call for more protections as well as immigration reform. Melinda Toothless was there.
The event, organized by the Connecticut AFL-CIO and pro-immigrant grassroots groups, drew members of more than a dozen unions and their supporters. The theme was The Time Is Now. Every speech was punctuated by lively Mexican cumbia music. First up was Governor Daniel Malloy, who noted some recent labor successes in the state.
We are the first state and the only state to have paid sick leave.
The law went into effect last year with strong support from the governor to get it passed. It provides service and retail workers of companies with 50 or more employees with 1 hour of sick time for every 40 hours that employee works. Malloy also touted the immigrant-friendly steps the state has taken, such as the DREAM Act, allowing undocumented students to pay in-state college tuition rates, and the current effort to allow undocumented residents to get driver's licenses. And back in 2007, New Haven created the first municipal resident ID card in the nation that was available regardless of immigration status, a card that's now carried by thousands of immigrants and citizens alike. Malloy concluded,
"We have another fight this year to win at the legislature, and that is to raise the minimum wage."
He supports raising the minimum wage to $9 an hour from its current $8.25, which is tied for fourth highest in the nation. Connecticut is a high cost of living state, and right now a person working full-time for minimum wage makes an annual salary of $16,500. Another speaker was Mark Ehrlich, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the New England Regional Council of Carpenters. He said immigrant workers from Central America, South America, and Eastern Europe have swelled the ranks of the construction workforce and transformed his industry.
"It is a system designed to profit unscrupulous employers, to exploit immigrant workers, and to undermine standards for all of us who work in construction."
Connecticut is home to almost 250,000 union members, a number that has declined steadily in recent years, including an almost 3 percentage point drop from 2011 to 2012, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Rallygoers hope to reverse that trend. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class shopping for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. And, of course, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So while the sports world is all a Twitter over the basketball player coming out, which I think is a huge story and good for him, and you know, I wish it weren't a story, to me the big story just broke. The fact that the state of Miami, or the state of Florida, not going to evidently not give a boatload of money to the people who own the, I guess it's now Sun Life Stadium, where the Dolphins play. I thought it was Joe Robbie Stadium. Must have missed that one. But no money. And it brings up the question to me, can professional sports, can they live in the world of the free market? I know they live in the world of free money, lots of it. As a kid growing up in Cleveland, you saw the Browns who abandoned Cleveland for Baltimore. For what? A ton of money, guaranteed sellouts for a decade, and of course all of the concession and parking they could stuff into their pockets. But the question is one, can professional sports live in the free world, in the free market? And this story in Florida, huge stuff, which is why I've asked Travis Waldron, a reporter over at Think Progress, to come talk to us about what happened in the Florida House. Travis, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I see this is a huge story to me. Finally, a state, a city has said, no, we're not going to give you millions of dollars to build a big, or to renovate or do anything to your big Coliseum.
Right, it is a big story. I think it's interesting because Joe Robbie Stadium, as you mentioned at the time, and now Sun Life Stadium, was actually built with all private funds back in the 80s, and now they say, you know, well, we need a new state, we need renovations to be able to host the Super Bowl and to have a state-of-the-art stadium. And, you know, that may be true, but at the same time, you know, you're voting to give $380 million and also some major property tax breaks to a millionaire and to a guy who frankly, you know, could probably finance this on his own if he really feels like it's necessary. And then to come out and say, As soon as the House decides not to do it, that you might move the team, or that this may not keep the team in South Florida. It's just ridiculous. But it is a big story. We don't often see state legislatures or city councils turn away billionaire owners who are looking for these kind of subsidies.
Now, to me, there are a couple of themes that popped out, one being obviously the veiled threat. And as I read the guy who is the CEO of the Dolphins, as I read his name's Mike D., the Dolphins CEO, as I read his statement, it wasn't that we're threatening to move. No, it's that we don't have a long-term lease with the city. And who knows? You never know. It's that veiled threat. It's that planting the seed that, you know, it's a possibility. Well, it's all a possibility. I grew up in Cleveland. I never imagined the Browns leaving until you saw that Modell go, hey, money? Yes, money. Screw the fans. Screw the city. Screw the people. It's all about dollars. And to me, that's what's wrong with professional sports.
Right. It's like they're holding the community hostage by saying, you know, well, we don't have a stake in the community, but you need to have a stake in us. And it's common throughout sports, as you mentioned. You see Sacramento last week coming up with a last-minute plan to keep the Kings there instead of letting them move to Seattle. And Seattle lost their basketball team because they decided not to do that. And in the NFL, you've had Minnesota give away a whole bunch of tax money because they were threatening to move to Los Angeles. And now you might see Jacksonville, Carolina, Miami, all of these teams that are going out and saying, hey, we have to have public money for stadiums or else we could move to Los Angeles or maybe to some other city. And it just is, it's a never-ending scheme on the part of these rich, frankly, mega-rich owners to try to extract a whole lot of corporate welfare out of taxpayers, and the deals always go bad for those taxpayers. So the idea that Mike D says Miamians need to have a stake in this team, that the community needs to have a stake in the team, the community put a stake in the Miami Marlins over the last 5 years to keep them in town. Yep. And look what happened. The deal's already gone bad. They're going to end up paying billions of dollars for the stadium before it's all done.
Yeah, I look at Cincinnati as another perfect example where they're literally selling off hospitals to pay the loans that the bonds that they took out to build the Reds and the Bengals' new stadiums.
Right. Or you look at Minnesota. They haven't even broken ground on the new stadium for the Vikings yet, and they're already coming up short of projections from the revenues that they were supposed to raise for it. You look at places like Santa Clara, where they're building a stadium for the 49ers, and before they even broke ground, taxpayer groups were saying, hold on, we don't think these numbers are going to work. And it's funny because the new stadium in Santa Clara is the one that Miami is trying to compete with to get get Super Bowl 50, and it's just like I said, it's really hard for taxpayers because you have so many cities, you have so many owners, and they kind of pit them against each other in this game of well, this city gave their team money, so why don't you give us some? And the NFL itself has a fund that will give out stadium loans, but you can only get those loans if you get public money to help finance the renovations of their stadium. It's just a ridiculous scheme that the league and owners and cross sports have cut up, and taxpayers always lose.
Yeah. You know, I guess the other question I had as I read this story is, you know, to host a Super Bowl, do you have to build a new stadium? Is that one of the prerequisites? Because, you know, as I'm looking at this, you know, they're saying the only way we're going to be able to compete is if we've got the latest, greatest, new, shiny thing for, you know, to keep the television cameras happy.
It's becoming that way. If you look at the last few Super Bowls, you had the one in Indianapolis where they had just built Lucas Oil Field there to replace the old dome. You have New Orleans where they had a ton of renovations to the Superdome after Hurricane Katrina, but also to get ready for the Super Bowl. They're going to Arlington where the new Cowboys Stadium is, and it's a never ending. Roger Goodell goes to these cities and he says, hey, you know, he makes the same veiled threats that Mike D and the Dolphins have made. Well, we can't say you won't get a Super Bowl if you don't give public money, but we also can't say that you will. And it's pretty clear that what he means is if you don't make this stadium state of the art, if you don't make it the nicest place where we can make the absolute most money for the owners, not for you, but for the owners, then, you know, you're not going to get the game.
Well, let me ask you this, Travis. You know, at these big events, these, you know, the Super Bowls and this stuff, all of this investment, all of this money that goes into these stadiums and all of the work that these cities do and the money they put in to compete for this. Do the taxpayers get a return on that? I mean, if does a host city even break even?
Usually there's a small benefit to the Super Bowl and big events like that. There, it's really hard to quantify what the benefit is, and it's almost never as big as tourism boards and governments will estimate. You know, when they say, when you read the reports from New Orleans this year that say, oh, they're going to have a $300 million impact or whatever the number they come up with, the simple rule from sports economists I've talked to is that you divide that by 10, and it's really easy, you know, $30 million boost, great, but how much did you put into renovating the stadium and tax dollars and all of that? And it, so your net gain is usually very small. There is a net gain at all, and they inflate these numbers on these economic impact studies with the pure purpose of trying to then backdoor their way into getting public funds and saying, well, if you spend the money on the stadium, it'll pay for itself because it'll boost the local economy. But you look at Sun Life Stadium, what, they're going to play 8 football games there a year? Mm. What are they going to do the other 357 days?
Cricket. I don't know, cricket.
Right, exactly.
Who knows? But it's not going to bring in that kind of money. And
right.
You know, Ron sent me an email during the segment here and said something that most people, I don't think, know. That the Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NHL, they're all under the IRS. They're all nonprofit corporations. And you see, then you go back, well, how much tax revenue do they put into the local coffers? You know, how much money is coming out of all of that?
Correct you on one thing real quick there. Major League Baseball is no longer a nonprofit. They gave away their nonprofit status because they didn't want to disclose executive salaries. But the NFL is a nonprofit. And so is the NHL. And so, yeah, they have complex schemes. It's way too complex to really dig into in one radio segment. It's way too complex, frankly, to even figure out at times. But yeah. They do use this nonprofit status to get away with a lot.
Because I keep asking the question, you know, that we hear about the free market and the free enterprise system, because one of the comments that the CEO of the Dolphins made, the CEO, Mr. D, he said that they can't do the renovations without a public-private partnership. And you go, but, you know, I keep hearing about the free market, and you're telling me you can't exist, you can't do these things without public money. And I go, well, you know, what benefit is it to society? I was giving you all this money. Couldn't I spend hundreds of millions of dollars in a much better fashion building roads and bridges and all kinds of other things? Just a thought.
Of course you could. That's the thing. Is like the reason a lot of people fall into this trap is because we do think that spending money on public investment is a good idea. It's just that stadiums and arenas are a really bad form of public investment. If you're going to spend it on education, spend it on roads, spend it on things that are going to put people back to work and help the economy out. And stadiums, like I said, aren't going to do that. When you're talking about a place that is going to have 8 football games a year or is going to have 41 basketball games a year, then you may have 20 or 30 concerts a year if you're lucky. But what are you doing the other 200 days, the other 300 days? And it's just not a very efficient form of public investment if what you're trying to do is actually help the economy. And there are actually studies that show that basketball arenas have a slowing effect on growth, that football stadiums don't do anything to help growth. It's just an absurd argument that for some reason has kept perpetuating itself. So there are more cities actually coming around to the idea. They've seen a lot of these disasters and realized that it's not worth it.
So let me ask you the last line of questioning I've got for you, because this was the most intriguing part of all of this. The Florida House didn't bring it up. The Senate, I believe, passed it. You said, here, we're going to give you the money, whatever you want. The House didn't. In fact, they're blaming it on one guy, this Will Weatherford, who I guess is the Speaker of the Florida House there. And I found interesting in the argument, in the article, that the owner, who is a huge contributor to Florida Republicans, in fact, a big donor to Mitt Romney, actually held a big fundraiser for him at his Palm Beach mansion, is pretty much saying he's going to fix the dysfunction because this Weatherford didn't give him the money that he wanted. And to me, that's another not-so-veiled threat.
Right. It's again, you have a guy who has a lot of money who is now going to try and take on what he thinks are special interests by just being a special interest himself. And it's again, what we see in politics across the spectrum, these wealthy people who have a lot of money to dump into their pet causes to get brains for themselves, and taxpayers don't obviously have the same amount of clout in state legislatures and in Congress, wherever they are. Now, I will say that Will Weatherford is viewed as a rising star in the Florida Republican Party. So if Stephen Ross, the Dolphins owner, decides to take him on, it's going to be very tough, especially because Weatherford has a lot of support from Miami area legislators in the state on this issue, because they are people who saw what happened when the Marlins stadium was built and financed the way it was, and that which led to recall elections and all kinds of sorts. So I think this is something where Weatherford is probably not out of the mainstream of Florida Republicans and Florida voters in general, especially in the southern part of the state.
Now, if we could only get that to spread and we stop this beggar thy neighbor development one way or another, be it through companies, you know, holding each state hostage and each city hostage, or sports teams doing the same thing.
Right, because it's really emblematic of a lot of the problems when you look at the states that do the race-to-the-bottom tax policies for companies. And the New York Times did a large story not that long ago, and it's kind of made a running series out of all these tax subsidies that are given out and how they have basically no effect on economic growth and are not really encouraging. And all it has turned into is a big-time competition between states to see who can get to the bottom first. And It's one of those ways where sports stadiums are just emblematic of a bigger problem in our political system and our views on economics a lot of times, where it just shows us that just giving away things to people who frankly don't need things given to them isn't going to help the broader society.
I'm with you. Travis, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Travis Waldron, reporter over at Think Progress, thinkprogress.org, the website. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts.
We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Finance life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
You see them in stores across our country and around the world. Colorful and stylish clothing with happy-sounding brand names like Children's Place, Papaya, Joe Fresh, Freestyle Baby, and Mango. But you don't see the factories where these cheerful garments are made, nor are we shown the strained faces of the impoverished workers who make them, paid little more than a dollar a day for long, hard shifts. We only catch a glimpse of the grim reality sewn into these happy brands when yet another factory is in the news for collapsing or burning down, bringing a grotesque death to hapless workers trapped inside. It's a horror that keeps happening, And after each one, the brand name marketers and retail profiteers cluck with sympathy for the families of the dead and decry the tragic accident. As Scott Nova of the Workers' Rights Consortium put it after the recent atrocity when a Bangladesh factory collapsed and crushed thousands of garment workers, the response is always the same, vague promises and public relations dodges, while the pile of corpses grows even higher. Is there something about clothing factories that makes them disaster magnets? Yes, the massive gravitational pull of corporate greed. Not merely the greed of sleazy factory owners, but, most significantly, the greed of such respectable retailers as Walmart, Benetton, Gap, and H&M. The April collapse in Bangladesh was not an accident, but the inevitable result of a Western business model that demands such low prices from offshore suppliers that worker safety is their dead last priority. This is Jim Hightower saying, in the corporate hierarchy, death is coldly built into the consumer price and routinely accepted in the boardrooms as a justifiable means of adding another dime to the bottom line. For information and action, go to www.workersrights.org. Workersrights.org. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Go on, take the money and run. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast at the website. Get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go as well. Our stat of the day comes from the people over at the Too Much Online blog, who point out that of the world's 200 richest people, Bloomberg News says at least one-third control part of their personal fortune through an offshore holding company or other entity that helps them make income more difficult to tax. They're sheltering their money. And I'm surprised that it's that low. I'm surprised it isn't higher, which is why if you go back to the 2012 presidential election, I kept harping on the fact that Mitt Romney didn't release his tax returns. Not because, and look, I was one of the few people who said, I don't think he's done anything illegal. I think, and this is what I wanted to see, is I think we've given so many special loopholes, so many special interests, so many ways of diverting and hiding and sheltering money to these very wealthy people that they don't really pay anything. And there's so many opportunities to hide it that, you know, they don't want everybody to know what it is that they've got. That's what it was for me. I wanted to see where it was so we could have a conversation around, is this loophole something we should, as a society, encourage? I'm a big fan in loopholes. And I've said this before. I'm a big fan of the idea of incentivizing certain behavior. The question becomes is, you know, is having the Delaware loophole wide open here in the state of Pennsylvania for these corporations to hide their profits, is it good for our state? Is it good for the country that 74% of the companies in this Commonwealth pay no state income tax? Is that good? And I don't think it is. You know, back when the top marginal tax rate was 92%, you know, to say, okay, well, we want to incentivize you building stuff, so we're going to give you a tax break to bring it down from 92%. And if you continue to do these things, yeah, you could bring that rate down in half or down to even a third, but you're still paying a third. When you've got 72% of the company pay nothing, I think you've incentivized a bit too much. Me doth think we've gone too far. And the conversation should be, how do we pull that back? And for me, that top rate, that big top rate's important. Because when you see the income numbers of those at the very top, the Ronald Johnsons of the world, the former CEO of JCPenney, who last year took, what was it, something along the lines of $53.3 million, while the average worker at JCPenney makes under 30, like 20, 29.5. So this guy's taking almost 1,800 times. His one salary could employ 1,800 people. There seems to me to be a tax problem there. Because during the Eisenhower years, the socialist Republican Dwight David Eisenhower, they'd have taxed the hell out of him. And the incentive was not to do that, was to reinvest in your company, to reinvest in new plants and reinvest in people so that you grew and that you did more. No, now it's, hey, let's steal what we can because JCPenney's in the tank. But he got his, man. I look at Abercrombie and Fitch, their CEO, Michael Jeffries, $48.1 million he took last year, while his employees make about $29.3 million total compensation. That's health care. That if they get health care, that's social, that's everything, health care, pensions, whatever, their wages, whatever, under 29, just around $29,000. And as you move down the line, you know, you've got the CEO of Simon Properties Group, David Simon, $137 million, almost 1,600 times the average of his workforce. Oracle, their CEO, Ellison, $96 million. The guy who, Starbucks, I mean, think about this. This is one of those that blew my mind. The guy who's the CEO of Starbucks took almost $30 million. Yet the person behind the counter making minimum wage makes about $25,000 a year. There's a serious problem here. And for me, this is one of those reasons why you absolutely need to unionize. And you just go down the list of these big corporations, you know, the Ralph Lauren's of the world, or Ralph Lauren is taking $36 million and his employees are making just over 30. You go down to Nike where their Nike CEO is making over $35 million bucks when they're the guy putting the shoes actually on your feet, making about $33,000. And let's not forget the fast food places. David Novak, the CEO of Yum Brands, that's your, that's your KFC, that's your, Kentucky Fried Chicken, it's those groups. Here, this guy makes $20 million while the average person, and I didn't think $24,000 a year, that must mean management's bringing those salaries up because minimum wage is not $24,000 a year. Same thing with Chipotle Mexican Grill. There's a guy who took almost $20 million while the average worker is making about $24,000 a year. It's the average. It's not the person who's serving you. And what's amazing to me is you've got these CEOs who say, well, if you don't give us all of this public money, if you don't give us all, you don't keep us on the dole while throwing our workers off the dole, we're going to go somewhere else. I mean, think of the perverse incentive here. And this is one of those things that just completely rocks my mind. You've got these CEOs who are saying, well, we need to be on the welfare line. We need to be collecting that welfare check. But our workers who are basically homeless, living on peanuts, we're going to kick them off of food stamps. We're going to kick them off of adult basic. We're going to kick them off of all of those programs that are supposed to help working people. Doesn't it seem wrong to you? Does something seem upside down? Have we fallen down the rabbit hole? I mean, really? There's something seriously screwed up here. And then you got these, I go back to when I was a kid. The Browns, I thought the Browns would be in Cleveland forever. Until Art Modell figured out, hey, I could pit Cleveland against Baltimore, and Maryland's going to give me a ton of money, guaranteed sellouts for 10 years. If I put the crummiest team on the field and I get all of the concessions and all of the parking, I get all this wonderful stuff. You know who lost? Taxpayers. Sad stuff, folks. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'll never bend. I'm with you now.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you.
Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Earth's oceans might be acidifying today faster than they did in the last 300 million years, according to research by an international team of scientists.
Scientists say that too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is changing ocean chemistry and endangering key parts of the marine food chain.
What's happening is that as more and more carbon dioxide is added to the atmosphere, the oceans act like a sponge to draw the excess CO2 from the air. Carbon dioxide and water bind together to create carbonic acid, the same stuff that's used to make soft drinks bubbly.
It's a change in ocean chemistry, an increased acidity that endangers some ocean plankton and makes it harder for creatures like corals and mollusks to build reefs and shells.
The paper authors reviewed hundreds of paleo-oceanographic studies and found evidence for only one period in the past 300 million years when the oceans changed as fast as today. That was about 56 million years ago, after a mysterious surge of carbon into the atmosphere.
But in the last 100 years, rising carbon dioxide from human activities has acidified the ocean at least 10 times faster than 56 million years ago, say the researchers.
Learn more about ocean acidification. Come to our website, earthsky.org, and search for it. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Our quote of the day from Jared Bernstein in his piece, Where Have All the Jobs Gone? He says, quote, a growing number of economists believe that our high levels of inequality are not just whacking the incomes of the have-nots, but are slowing job growth as well. And I keep saying, look, you know, we've got a governor who hasn't done what he said he was going to do, which is going to actually create jobs. We've got a House of Representatives on the federal level who came in 2010, all about jobs, jobs, jobs. Remember, laser-like focus, have done everything but. And what you've got is a generation of workers, a generation of college graduates who are coming out and going, where are the jobs? And the reality is that they're just not being creative for a bunch of reasons. And a lot of it is bad policy. It's a lot of it's austerity. And a lot of it is just corporate greed. We can get those working people to do more for a hell of a lot less. And for me, I keep saying what we need to be doing is get in the streets, get out and screaming and hollering and carrying on to get attention. Because, you know, we've been getting screwed for the last 30 years. And I go back to myself. Okay, 1988, I was throwing boxes on a shipping dock for $15 an hour. Doing that exact job today, they're paid not even $12 an hour. There's something seriously wrong with that. It comes down to the fact that, well, we've seen an attack on organized labor. So when I see people going out in the streets, when I see people saying, hey, we need to organize, we need to fight back, we got to get it on the program. So I've asked Drew Novak. He is a TWU member and also a chairperson for TWU. Young Worker Committee. Drew, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rick.
Tell me, I understand on May Day, you and a number of other folks from across the country, members of TWU and members of other unions, out in the streets of New York, saying, hey, we demand decent jobs. We demand health care. We demand.
That's right. Yeah. In particular, young workers across the country, we all came together in New York as TWU young members, and we held a rally in the morning where we took it right to the offices. We went into the lobbies of union busting law firms, and we went into the headquarters of the MTA, and we let them know that we were there.
And to me, you know, I've often said that I wish that working people, people like you and me and my listeners, I wish we would take workers' rights as seriously and be as militant about our rights as you see some like the NRA members who are as militant about gun rights. I think we need to have that kind of militancy. We need to be taking to the streets and when there's inequality, when there's injustice, we call it out.
Well, yeah, you're right. I agree completely. And you know, we've started to see that more and more, especially over the last few years. You know, in my home state of Michigan, they just passed Right to Work, and we were out there in Lansing, at the Capitol as well, you know, telling them how we felt. But, you know, part of the problem these days is complacency, even complacency among the union ranks, and especially with the younger members.
So let me ask you about this Right to Work, this wonderful, mystical thing you speak of. What right did you get from it?
Well, we got absolutely no rights.
Did you get any work? Any work?
No work yet.
Okay, so no rights and no work. So what's magical about it?
What's magical about it is that now people can work at a union shop and get all the union coverage and get all the union protections and not have to pay a penny.
And as I understand it, you know, you look at the states that have passed this wonderful mythical thing. The workers in all across all of union, non-union, whatever words you use, they all make less. So somehow the only thing that I seem to find out is that you don't seem to get any rights or any work, but you get a lot less money.
Yeah, that's true. And you get a lot less benefits, a lot less health care. But, I mean, yeah, it really is. It's just an attack on the unions from the right wing. And they're just trying to, you know, mainly lower our political clout by taking away our union dues.
So let me ask you, you know, in talking about the younger generation, as a committee person for TWU's Young Worker Committee, you know, we hear a lot about the younger generation, and a lot of them don't, correct me if I'm wrong, and I probably am on this, because, you know, this is a right-wing talking point, that the younger generation, they're not joiners. You know, they realize they're going to change jobs 100 times over their careers, and you know, that union thing is just outdated, something that their grandparents needed, not something that they're going to need. Is that the way young workers see things today?
No, I don't think young workers see it like that at all. I think some don't take the time to get involved and take the time to know what's happening in their workplace. I mean, the biggest things that are going on at union shops now are affecting the younger workers the most. Temporary work, part-time work, contracting out to private companies.
Two-tier wage systems.
Huh?
Two-tier wage structures.
Two-tier wage structure. That just happened in a couple of places here in Michigan. Yeah, I mean, what it is, you know, the guy who's got 30 years in, all these attacks and all these remedies that they're coming up with to lower our wages and take away our retirement, that guy with 30 years, he's going to be okay. It's me. It's all my colleagues who have got 3, 4, 5 years at a union shop. We're the ones who, when we retire, aren't going to have the retirement. We're the ones who, in 10 years, aren't going to have the health care that we have now. And that's why we all, as young workers, have to get together, because we need to take it back.
Now, you know, the sad thing, Drew, is the guy with 30 years, he's not okay. He may think he's going to be okay, but if there's nothing behind him to help support his future, he's not going to be there either. And that's, you know, that's the thing that that I think the older generation has been lulled into believing that, yeah, you know, we could push that down and screw that next generation if that's the thought, and it's not going to affect us. It's going to, though.
Oh, yeah, no, don't get me wrong. I understand that it's everybody. It's all the workers, no matter how many years they got in and what age they're at. They're all affected by this legislation. But my main focus is really trying to organize and get rid of the complacency among the younger generation, thinking And as you said before, you know, some of the young people do think that the union, what is it good for? What has it done for me? And that's half of our goal with the TWU Young Workers Committee, is to get out there, educate, you know, develop future leaders, and let them know that it's your union and you have to fight for it. They're not just going to give it to you.
Absolutely. I agree with you. So in your day of action, what kind of responses did you get from folks when you were out doing your actions?
Well, it was pretty interesting because we had about 200, maybe 250 with us on our march, and it was an unpermitted march, and we left Bryant Park. And only about 20, 25 of us knew that we were actually going to storm into lobbies. So it was that front group that knew. And as soon as we went into that first lobby, and you could even see it on the police officers' faces, they were shocked. And as we came back out, the other people in the march who were from other unions, from the Occupy movement and just activists in general, they were smiling and giggling. They were like, oh, man, this is not a typical union march. They never kind of do these kind of things.
Well, for me, I'm a firm believer. Look, at this point, labor has been backed so far into a corner with the attacks on so many levels, all of the ALEC legislation and all of the attacks by these corporations. At some point, the militancy has to return. There's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat until you say no more.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, at this point, you know, just lobbying politicians and just doing, you know, random demonstrations isn't really working for us at this point. And we do need to be more vocal and more militant and out there and letting people know that we're not going to go away and we're not just going to take, you know, take the cuts and take the, like you said, the austerity.
You know, for me, and this is one of the reasons that we're doing this cross-country labor history tour, this bus tour out to San Jose for the Netroots Nation convention, is basically just labor education. You know, I realize that my children get nothing. There's nothing in the schools that teaches them about the history of work in this country and the struggles that it took to create a middle class and to create opportunity for people who work for a living, which is why I think it's important we talk about labor history with the younger generation, because, you know, I look at what you're doing with this Young Workers Committee. It's that education that I would assume, and may correct me if I'm wrong, that most of your members have never heard. They've never heard any of the battles. They just think the 8-hour day was bestowed upon them by a benevolent corporation, and that all of these things that we get were just handed over.
Right. Yeah. Most don't know the history, and in fact, every time we have one of our meetings or one of our events, you know, on the first day we always open up with like a history of TWU, with a history of labor in general, and it's really important to know where you came from. You know, you went from 6 day, you're working 6-7 days a week, 12-13 hour days, you know, no overtime pay, all kinds of things. You know, without the unions, we wouldn't have the 8-hour workday, we wouldn't have the weekend, we wouldn't have overtime, we wouldn't have so many things, too many to list right now.
And as I told my 10-year-old daughter, she'd be working in the looms. You know, 100 years ago, that's where 10-year-old girls were. They were working in the looms, you know, making very nice, intricate stitching on things that wealthy people bought.
Right, right. And as we just saw in Bangladesh, possibly the roof collapsing in on you.
Yeah, and, you know, that was our history as well. You go back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, exactly the same scenario. They lock the doors. They chain the doors shut because someone might take a scrap.
Right.
And what
do you
end up with? Hundreds of people murdered, in my view.
Right. No, I agree completely, and that's exactly what it was. It's all about, it was greed. It still is about greed today.
So after this event, after the May Day set of events, where do you guys go from here? You know, that's the starting point. It's a growing point. Where do you go from here?
Well, basically, we all go back to our different cities across the country, and now it's up to us to organize those members within our locals, those young people, and do actions within our own community. And of course, we'll be getting back together as a group somewhere in the near future. But it's all about not letting off the gas pedal. We now have to go out and we have to sign up young members and we have to encourage them. We have to educate them and we have to make sure that we're out there letting our voices be heard.
No, I think that's so very important. And not just organizing your members, but also, you know, talking to people, the general community, about why it's important that the TWU members have rights on the job. You know, that the bus driver has the ability to say, you know what, this vehicle's unsafe. For the good of the public, I'm not going to take it. And actually have some backing from their union to say, we're going to stand behind them. You're not going to force that out onto the road. You know, as a truck driver for a number of years, you know, I was grateful to have that chance. I know so many people who don't have the ability, don't have the voice, don't have the say on the job to say, I'm not taking it. And down the road they go. So, you know, that conversation has to be had to the general public as well, Drew.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, you mentioned bus driver. That's exactly what I am. I'm a bus driver here in Michigan. And you mentioned about, you know, unsafe conditions. And even still today, there are bus drivers who don't know their rights and will operate a bus when they felt it was unsafe, and they'll come back to me the next day or something and be like, man, I didn't feel safe and I didn't want to do it. And I reiterate to them, I go, well, that's when you call your dispatch and you say you're not moving until this problem is taken care of.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, you get into an accident, something happens, it's your behind.
And, exactly. You know, it's your license.
And, you know, that supervisor can say, well, I never told them. We've been down that road. I've seen that, which is why I keep telling workers, you need to have that voice. You need to have that say. And why I'm glad to see that you're out there, and that hopefully we'll see some events going on across the country and more engagement, more activation. Drew, I appreciate the time, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rick. It was good to be here.
Thanks so much. I love the idea of a young workers committee, and we should be engaging more people in the public. Going to take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance. Public divided, either they love us or they hate us. Profit billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have spoken to a cap
that we never give up.
We'll be here one day longer.
One day longer.
The people's voice is stronger.
We will win the
struggle. We work hard for our money, we will talk with respect. Keep fighting for these rights for generations that's next. One day longer.
Class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
On July 5th, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations in industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
If the federal government continues to do the kinds of things that this administration is trying to do through the back door, through the National Labor Relations Board, that's killing our free market system.
We're running out of rich people in this country.
The NLRB has become a political sycophant for labor unions.
And one of the things the Congress should do immediately is defund the National Labor Relations Board.
It seems to me that what we're seeing is a ceding of power from Congress to these, to the NLRB and other agencies.
It really is a freedom versus tyranny issue.
I'm a member of the GOP, trying to form a plutocracy, but if I can just bamboozle you, and you'll share my narrow point of view, what a wonderful world this would be.
It would be such a wonderful world if we could get people to work for pennies. If we could get them to work for soda. You know, if we could just say, you know what, we're going to pay you in cans of soda. You're not going to actually get money. And the reason that's funny is I actually know somebody who, yeah, you know, he's actually had to work for soda, which is kind of funny. But what the message it sends me is, you know, you've got this, you're creating this desperation class. You're creating this low-wage workforce that's pulling all of us down. And look, the right wing in this country, they perfectly understand. If you can starve the minimum wage, if you can destroy that social safety net, we can make people desperate. And if they're desperate, well, they'll work for pennies. And then we can continue to pull everybody down. So while we see these, and like we talked about earlier, while we see these CEOs who are just bloated with government welfare, while they're just bloated with handouts and special interests, while they're on the dole like you cannot believe. The message we hear from the extremists on the right is, well, they're those lazy people, those people who are collecting food stamps, and those people who are in unemployment, those drug addicts and those alcoholics who can't pass a drug test. Corporate CEOs, fat and happy. The welfare floweth, and the more jobs governor handeth out more. Every year in his budget, there's more welfare for these big corporations, isn't there? But for people who actually need a little welfare, need to put food on the table, screw you. And there was an interesting story I just came across this morning on the asset test. Because you'll remember our more jobs governor, you know, the guy who's created 1,000 private sector jobs in the last year, the more jobs governor. Yeah, more than Wyoming. They instituted this asset test. If you're over the age of 60, or if you have some sort of disability, and you have $9,000 in assets, and there's a whole long, complicated process to determine your assets, you're no longer eligible to collect food stamps. Sorry, you've got assets. Starve. Or wait till they're all gone and you're completely destitute, and then we'll consider. If you're under 60 and you have more than $5,500 in assets, you're disqualified. So nothing for you. And they're saying that in the last year, there have been about 4,000 families who've been denied assistance because of this excess resource, what the Department of Public Welfare is calling an excess resource, which means people who have a couple of pennies in the bank or have some assets. Now, you're talking about, it's a small number considering the 1.8 million people in the state who are getting some form of food assistance. But still, you're talking about 4,000 families in our community. 4,000 people could be you or me. And for me, I look at this asset test as just another one of those roadblocks that the right has put in the way to make sure that people don't qualify, that they make it impossible almost to get these programs. In fact, they point out that approximately 80,000 applications for food stamps every month that go on, about a third of them are rejected because of some paperwork, verification of documents, or some hurdle or obstacle. So of the 80,000 people who apply every month, what you end up with is you get a third of them who have to go another month filling out paperwork and all of that. Because we need to make sure you're desperate enough, right? And then we'll drug test you because, hey, you know, let's make it a little more indignant. Now, the people who would qualify, and look, there are a lot of people in this state who would qualify. If you're a family of four, the poverty level is $23,550. If you're a family of four and you fall below that, you could qualify for some measure of food assistance. And there is nothing wrong with asking for help. There is nothing wrong with asking for help to put food on your table for your children. There is not. And I remember as a kid, you know, growing up, there were times where my mother was on ADC. It was Aid to Dependent Children back then. Because, you know, she lost her job. And there was nothing else. So the only way that food got put on our table some months was because we got some assistance from we the people. Of which now I don't complain about paying taxes. Because I know that there's a kid just like me out there who's struggling to make it to the next day, who's struggling to make it through the next meal because you know what? There's nothing in the cupboards. And that he's going to have opportunity, and we're going to make sure that he's got a shot, a chance to get into that middle class so that he can pay taxes and that he can raise the next generation without those fears, without those problems, and break that cycle of poverty. For me, that's the reason that you have these programs. Not to put obstacles in the way, not to screw people over, and certainly not to discourage them saving, to put a couple of bucks in the bank for a real emergency. Or, you know, hey, heaven forbid you have some assets. You know, what happens if you own your house and you lose your job for several months and you have nothing? Oh yeah, you gotta sell that. Sorry. Nothing for you. You've got assets. Something wrong with the society, something wrong with the direction, especially when we're giving billions of dollars to these corporate CEOs and these big corporations. Something seriously freaking wrong there. Quick break, right back.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
Hundreds of workers gathered on the green in New Haven, Connecticut on May Day for a statewide celebration of workers' victories and a call for more protections as well as immigration reform. Melinda Tuhus was there.
The event, organized by the Connecticut AFL-CIO and pro-immigrant grassroots groups, drew members of more than a dozen unions and their supporters. The theme was "The Time Is Now." Every speech was punctuated by lively Mexican cumbia music. First up was Governor Daniel Malloy, who noted some recent labor successes in the state.
We are the first state and the only state to have paid sick leave.
The law went into effect last year with strong support from the governor to get it passed. It provides service and retail workers of companies with 50 or more employees with 1 hour of sick time for every 40 hours that employee works. Malloy also touted the immigrant-friendly steps the state has taken, such as the DREAM Act allowing undocumented students to pay in-state college tuition rates, and the current effort to allow undocumented residents to get driver's licenses. And back in 2007, New Haven created the first municipal resident ID card in the nation that was available regardless of immigration status, a card that's now carried by thousands of immigrants and citizens alike. Malloy concluded,
"We have another fight this year to win at the legislature, and that is to raise the minimum wage."
He supports raising the minimum wage to $9 an hour from its current $8.25, which is tied for fourth highest in the nation. Connecticut is a high cost of living state, and right now a person working full-time for minimum wage makes an annual salary of $16,500. Another speaker was Mark Ehrlich, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the New England Regional Council of Carpenters. He said immigrant workers from Central America, South America, and Eastern Europe have swelled the ranks of the construction workforce and transformed his industry.
"It is a system designed to profit unscrupulous employers, to exploit immigrant workers, and to undermine standards for all of us who work in construction."
Connecticut is home to almost a quarter million union members, a number that has declined steadily in recent years, including an almost 3 percentage point drop from 2011 to 2012, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Rallygoers hope to reverse that trend. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
This report was made possible in part by a grant from the Burger Marx Foundation.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Let me say this as emphatically as I can. Who cares about Mitt Romney's tax returns? Secondly, I love the fact that the guy is rich. You got people who are trying to make it seem like being rich is bad.
Welcome back to the Rich Smith Show. It'll be interesting. It'll be very interesting to see Obama's nominee for Commerce Secretary, Penny Pritzker, go through the nomination, through the confirmation process. It's going to be very interesting because just what Herman said. I mean, the Republicans, you know, their candidate was, you know, Mr. 1% himself, Mitt Romney. It's going to be very interesting to me to see the kind of questions, the kind of attacks that they go after, because here she is, the face, in my view, of the 1%. You know, someone, I shouldn't use the hardest day of work she's done has gone through the birth canal line. It's probably not 100% accurate. She's probably done something once or twice. But you know, what's interesting is it's going to be very amusing to me to see the Herman Cains and them go say things about her, because that's their party. That's their view. Me, I got a lot of problems with Penny Pritzker as Commerce Secretary, and here to help me work through some of them, I've asked Jackson Potter to come with us. He's with the Chicago Teachers Union, who I'm sure, being from Chicago, has quite an opinion on Penny. Jackson, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this, and you know, you go back to the election of 2012, where you had Romney and the Republicans defending the wealthy. How are they going to attack her? She's got a lot of baggage, offshore accounts, you know, all kind of stuff. How are they going to attack her?
Well, she had a bank deal that didn't go so hot, so that'll certainly be something they mention. You know, what I would suggest is talk about how, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be Republican talking points, but working families in America fared very poorly under her stewardship, both of us, of the schools, here in Chicago in the tax system. She's diverted a lot of money away from parks, libraries, and schools to, for example, her wealthy hotel chain, the Hyatt of luxury hotels, through a program known as tax increment financing. Well, what does that portend for, you know, people, mom-and-pop stores, struggling families across the country if she has purview over entire economic policy?
It's a good question. And my, I guess the other question I have, since you brought up education, is she one of the people pushing for privatization of public education? And in my view, the destruction of that, of public education.
Absolutely. Herself and some of her brothers and sisters donated immense amounts of money to Stand On Children, known as Stand For Children. We call them Stand On Children, that helped to lead a huge campaign to bust our union and destroy our contract rights in 2010. And it was her seed money, along with Republican notables like Bruce Rauner, who's now running for governor and is insane about wanting to destroy all public sector unions, and Griffin, who is a hedge fund operator and well-known in Republican circles. So there's virtually indistinguishable in terms of her educational policies and beliefs to her Republican counterparts. And as a result, she was promoting charter schools right and left. One of her family members has a charter school named after him and was seeding money to all kinds of these entrepreneurial experiments on poor children of color that have not borne fruit and not delivered on their promises and destroyed the lives of many union teachers and paraprofessionals. So real problems here. And she was the first billionaire ever appointed to the school board by a multimillionaire who came out of finance, Rahm Emanuel, and together they operated a very hostile approach to our union and to the public schools and students that we serve.
So let me ask you, in looking at the confirmation process, where do you think she's going to get the most pushback from? Because, I look at her and she's right in line with the Republican view, very pro-business, going to toe the Republican line. Breaking unions and big tax breaks and all of those things for corporations and deregulation. I'm sure that's part of it. Where is she going to get the any pushback from them? And, will the Democrats just carry the water and say, she's our gal. We've got to hold our nose and move forward.
Yeah, I'm sure that it'll be a pretty superficial attack, that focuses primarily on her snafus in finance and the bank that went under her stewardship. So they'll kind of try and paint the picture that she's ineffective as a manager. That'll probably backfire because she's a strong female leader in the business world that's devoid of a lot of, has a glass ceiling. So that works in Obama's favor. I think you've hit the nail on the head, though, is that there's virtually no difference in terms of Republicans and Democrats on this issue, other than maybe quibbling with some of her record as a steward of the economy, which is what she's being promoted as under the Obama's appointment. So, it really begs the question, if she's been really vicious in undermining the livelihoods of countless workers and their families and the students who depend on public schools, whether you look at the Hyatt hotel chain and the housekeepers that, work under very impoverished wages and salaries and can barely feed their families and make the rent because of a refusal to negotiate a proper contract for those workers, to the teachers in the schools and the decimation of countless numbers of schools that have been closed, turned around, and consolidated. It really is troubling. And then Penny's got a bad history of appealing her property tax bills. So here she is running the school system, essentially, and the money that the school system depends on to educate poor children, primarily, she's challenging it. She has this McMansion in a wealthy part of town and can fully bear the burden of paying a little extra and refuses to do so.
Yeah, I mean, to me, we've talked to a number of the Hyatt housekeepers. In fact, we've talked to Kathy Youngblood a couple of times here on the program, and the stories that they tell, you know, one of those things that just make you go, yeah, this is the person that you're putting up as the person who's the head of the commerce. There's just something seriously wrong with the message alone that's being sent. And from a Democrat, I would understand this from a Republican, but from a Democrat who talks of, you know, we need to have workers who have rights and unions and that stuff. To me, this just seems to be the wrong appointment. Now, look, I understand, you know, she's raised a lot of money for his campaigns. I understand that. But to me, this just sends the wrong message.
And it's not just the Democrats' fault, though. It's also the labor movement has been silent. As far as I know, the Chicago Teachers Union is the only local in the country that's raised any objections to this appointment. You know, Trump has been silent. AFL-CIO has nothing to say about it. And yet this record clearly indicates this is a bad deal for workers and their families. And so it really kind of raises a number of alarms as to what's the role of organized labor in challenging, you know, these decisions that work against their interests, and why aren't they doing it more frequently?
Let me ask you this. How many, there are some that I've talked to who think that, well, yeah, it's a figurehead position. It's, you know, it's not something she's going to have a lot of influence over. So, you know, they're putting in, these are just appointments of, you know, hey, you may raise some money for me. Thanks. Here, congratulations. Here's like an ambassadorship, or here's the head of this. But the departments are still going to run. The bureaucracy is still going to run, and she's not going to have an awful lot of influence. What do you say to something like that?
It's like we're in some kind of a absurdist parallel universe where the rich, because by virtue of all the money they pay into the political system, get to have this pageantry of, you know, kind of, fake offices that they can waltz around and show, you know, how great they are. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so if you're going to use government for that purpose, it really hollows out the democracy and shows that it's just a figment of our imagination. And what we really need to be insisting upon is that if Obama's going to appoint people to influential positions, that they are advocates, that they represent the constituents that put them in office, and that they're going to go to bat for them, not that they're just going to hang around and look nice.
Yeah. I mean, because there's part of me that goes, okay, let me give Obama the benefit of the doubt, which I'm not in this case, but just for argument's sake, and
sure,
say, you know, this is maybe an opportunity to quell some of the, he's anti-business, even though that's completely ludicrous based on the people that he's appointed in the past. But, you know, maybe is there an argument to be made for him trying to reach out to the business community because they have done such a pathetic job of job creation? They're sitting on mountains of cash and that they're not investing in our economy, that this was an outreach to them to say, okay, we put one of you in charge again, in charge of the Commerce Department. Now go help create some jobs. Could that play into this at all? Or is this just, you know, it's just business as usual?
Well, I mean, in that case, why not appoint somebody like Warren Buffett, who's actually on record saying we need to drastically increase the taxation of the wealthiest Americans? Instead, you pick somebody who's done the exact opposite, has concentrated her wealth, has deprived public institutions of much needed funding, has bludgeoned the workforce in her luxury hotel chain, refused to give them what they need and deserve for many years. And just, you know, begs the question, why her? If that's really your true intention, is to reach out to the business community, there's plenty of businessmen out there who are critical and have questioned the way in which the system operates and benefits the few at the expense of the many. And it just seems like that's where you should be signaling your intentions, not, you know, increasing the wealth and concentration of the 1%.
Excellent point. That's a really an excellent point. Last question I've got for you. You know, in this confirmation process, do you think anybody's going to ask her for her tax returns? I mean, is that going to be part of this, do you think? Because for me, like the Romney campaign, my ask for his tax returns were not that I think he did anything illegal. I don't think there's anything criminal. I don't think that he was evading taxes by breaking the law. I think he was evading taxes by using the law, and I'd really love to know where that money is, what shelters, what offshore havens, where the wealth class hides their money, and then have a conversation around, is that something that's good for our society?
Yeah, I mean, I think you asked exactly the right question. You hit it on the head. You know, why are we questioning, you know, tax shelters when it comes to Republican candidates and not when it comes to Democratic appointees? Seems like if our real concern is tax equity, ensuring fairness, and making certain that our public services are funded at the levels that are required to really give people a chance in this society. And, yeah, man, I hope the Republicans do that. I mean, they have every interest in doing so because it will show the hypocrisy of how this has played out.
Yeah. And if you want more information on Hyatt and the things that they do, the website would be HyattHertz.org. There's an awful lot of information there about the campaign going on with the Hyatt Hotels. It's just mind-blowing stuff. We'll put a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Jackson, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the input and the thoughts. Thank you.
No, thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right, Jackson Potter with the Chicago Teachers Union. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts. Tax returns? Yes? No? I say yes.
Well, we're used to that. Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we've lowered our rates just in time for summer. Get the car you truly want with a 2.99 annual percentage rate. New, used, or simply refinance the car you already have. Choose a payment term of 6 or 7 years, which means more cash in your pocket now. Additional rates and terms are available. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseCU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
You see them in stores across our country and around the world. Colorful and stylish clothing with happy-sounding brand names like Children's Place, Papaya, Joe Fresh, Freestyle Baby, and Mango. But you don't see the factories where these cheerful garments are made, nor are we shown the strained faces of the impoverished workers who make them, paid little more than a dollar a day for long, hard shifts. We only catch a glimpse of the grim reality sewn into these happy brands when yet another factory is in the news for collapsing or burning down, bringing a grotesque death to hapless workers trapped inside. It's a horror that keeps happening. And after each one, the brand name marketers and retail profiteers cluck with sympathy for the families of the dead and decry the tragic accident. As Scott Nova of the Workers' Rights Consortium put it after the recent atrocity when a Bangladesh factory collapsed and crushed thousands of garment workers, the response is always the same, vague promises and public relations dodges, while the pile of corpses grows even higher. Is there something about clothing factories that makes them disaster magnets? Yes, the massive gravitational pull of corporate greed. Not merely the greed of sleazy factory owners, but, most significantly, the greed of such respectable retailers as Walmart, Benetton, Gap, and H&M. The April collapse in Bangladesh was not an accident, but the inevitable result of a Western business model that demands such low prices from offshore suppliers that worker safety is their dead last priority. This is Jim Hightower saying, in the corporate hierarchy, death is coldly built into the consumer price and routinely accepted in the boardrooms as a justifiable means of adding another dime to the bottom line. For information and action, go to www.workersrights.org. Workersrights.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties.
I think people are, the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about the potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money. Even if it has been money for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
Ah, yes. Gold fever. Yes. The only thing better than gold fever is gun fever. If you saw it over the weekend, the NRA had their big convention. Gun fever. Guns. No, Charlton Heston. No, Charlton Heston. Just Glenn Beck. Kind of, I liked Charlton Heston better. Not so much Glenn Beck. But some interesting things that came out of, and I love the pictures that came out of the big convention, especially the outreach of the NRA to women. Because we need to have his and her assault weapons, of course. You know, nothing says femininity like a pink assault weapon. Nothing at all. And the bumper sticker, a lady with a gun has more fun. I'm not quite sure what that means, but heck, yeah, good. I liked the undergarments that were doubled as holsters for not only, you know, but guns as well. And as I'm looking at the bra that it doubles as a gun holster, my first thought was, you know, how exactly are you supposed to get to it? Because it's an undergarment. That means that there's something over it. And I know that, you know, it's not about that. It's about the point. How do you get it? How do you access it quickly? Just a thought. And I loved a lot of the stuff, you know, you got to love the entrepreneurial spirit. You got to get people all worked up because they got to have their gun 24/7. Because there was some real craziness that came out of this convention. Probably the scariest, you know, was the fact that you've got this instructor, this guy who is one of the NRA's, you know, top home defense course instructors, who's saying that you should store your guns in your kid's room. Now he's saying you have a safe in the room, you know, put the gun safe, have gun safes everywhere. In every room, you should have guns everywhere. And, you know, beyond the fact that you're going to put a gun in a kid's room, it kind of makes me go, do I want to live in that kind of society where you're talking about what kind of world do these people live in constant fear? At any minute, there someone's going to break through the door and they're going to shoot us all. So we got to have guns everywhere. Doesn't it seem that way to you? I mean, and the other part of this is, you know, the outreach to women, because they realize, most women go, well, wait a second, guns kill people, guns kill our children, maybe we should not have them everywhere. And maybe it's, and, you know, the whole bra thing with the gun just kind of blew my mind, because, you know, is this where we're going? Where everywhere we go, we have to have guns. You know, wear your gun everywhere. You know, and I was thinking about this, you know, as I was reading through these stories, and I was remembering the woman from Lebanon, who, you may remember the story, she wore a sidearm to her six-year-old daughter's soccer practice. And I remember at the time going, you know, what kind of a fear-laden society does she find herself? What in her world is so scary that, you know, she needs to feel the security of carrying this sidearm? And then all the other discussions that went around carrying a visible sidearm, which was, you know, the whole idea of carrying a concealed weapon from the people that I know who I consider gun experts, is that element of surprise that, uh-oh, you've got it. By carrying this thing, now if you're going to get in trouble, you're inviting more trouble, a larger element. And I was thinking about her today. You know, just because the story is so bizarre. You know, here was this woman who, you know, she, and I remember asking the question. And the reality is that she lived in a very dangerous world that I don't think most of us do. Or at least I hope most of us don't. Where her husband killed her while she was talking to somebody on Skype or on, you know, video chat or whatever. You know, shot and killed her right there with one of the family guns. While her gun was hanging right near her, and then he went upstairs and blew and shot himself with a shotgun. You know, is that the fear-laden world? You know, did the guns keep the couple together? I mean, because there's part of me goes, I saw the his and her assault weapons, and I go, wow, I can see the Mother's Day message on that. Nothing keeps a couple closer than his and her assault weapons. Understand. And, you know, for all the people going, oh, you're just anti. I'm not anti-gun. I'm anti-saturation of guns. I'm anti-it being everywhere. You want to own a gun to go hunting or target shooting or to defend your home, fine. But this cultural push towards saturation of guns everywhere by the manufacturing industry, there's something seriously wrong. There's just like, there's a... There's really a very twisted view behind this. And, you know, for the people who say, well, crime is up and we need guns everywhere, it's because we've cut funding for cops. We've got an economy that's been limping along. Crime goes up as poverty goes up. It's common sense. Give people opportunity. Give people a chance. But instead, what we're talking about doing is, well, curing the symptoms with more disease. And for me, I look at this and I think about this woman who the report at the time, and I remember it vividly, it was a couple years ago, but the report at the time is they had taken several handguns out of the house, shotguns, rifles, and what they quoted as several hundred rounds of ammunition. And you go, you know, what kind of world did these people see? What kind of fear-laden world did they look out their window and see? And I look at this story, and I've actually interviewed this guy, Adam Kokesh, in the past. You know, it was against the war in Iraq, and he was one of the outspoken people against the war. And, you know, I said, look, you know, this is, you know, I agree, there's some things we've got to do. He's now turned into one of these libertarian talk show hosts, and good for him. He is, according to reports, he's part of a group planning a march on Washington, D.C. on July 4th. And the purpose for the march is to have people show up with their guns loaded. And you go, okay, well, you know, what's the point in this? You know, you're making a statement. Their Facebook page says, you know, the march is nonviolent, or so they claim, with the quotations of unless the government chooses to make it violent. And for me, there's all these veiled threats that keep being thrown around. There's all of this veiled stuff that says, well, you know, we're going to show the government. Look. This idea that we're going to overthrow our government with bullets, that train has left the station. It ain't happening. I think most people would agree that ain't happening. But for those who think that they can, I look at this. You got 900 people who claim they're going to show up with loaded weapons. To me, this is one of those moments where you go, we're looking to instigate. We want something to happen so we can make a big stink out of it. This is not about, in my view, about the gun issue. It's not about the Second Amendment issue. It's about creating a really, really ugly situation that could only get worse. And to say, well, we're going to be nonviolent, like, you know, like civil rights people, is ludicrous, because I don't remember Martin Luther King walking with a firearm. I don't remember Congressman Lewis, who had his head split open in Selma. I don't remember him walking with a firearm. This is very interesting to me, because what it's telling me is these are people who want confrontation. And I've met so many gun people. And look, I know a lot of folks who are good, decent, honest, hardworking, law-abiding gun owners who, you know, the thought of this is just going to repel them and repulse them. But I've known some who you listen to their fantasy about how they're going to pull out their big gun and stick it to whoever has the nerve to break. It's almost pornographic. This fantasy world, and I still, I'll probably never forget, sitting in the lunchroom having to listen to this diatribe about how he can't wait. And it was, in my view, it was really very X-rated. And part of me goes, this is that group that's attracted to this. Because there are people who, like these folks, who anything they can do to cause a stir. And there's part of me, and I think about this from a labor perspective. I wish that there were some folks, I wish that workers would view their rights on the job and their paycheck and their family security in the same militant way that a lot of these NRA people see it. Because what we're seeing right before our very eyes is that destruction of the ability to have a middle class or a reasonable existence. And they keep us stupid with divisive issues that are never going to go away. But finally, one last thing I want to talk about on the guns issue. Florida Republican Rich Nugent, congressman there, he has put forth the Ammo Act, or the Ammunition Management for More Attainability, the Ammo Act. That's actually a pretty good one. I like how they fit those into these cute little name, the cute little acronyms there. Anyway, the basis of the Ammo Act is to limit the amount of ammo the government buys, because the right wing believes that the government is hoarding ammo, for their military and for their police departments. So what this bill is going to do is it's going to stop the government from stockpiling ammunition. Okay. I guess that's right up there with the guy who, Wayne LaPierre, the guy who said that, I'll bet you those people in Boston wish they had their guns. No, Wayne. They wish that some maniac didn't make a homemade bomb. That's probably what they wished. Jerk. Let's take a quick break. When we come back and talk with Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. 2561.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
It's the Rick Smith Show.
I still think, his and her assault weapons, that's what keeps a couple together, right? At least that's what I got out of the NRA convention this weekend. Pink assault weapons, little bra holsters, little wonderful things. It keeps a couple together. Just wonderful, wonderful stuff. Gotta love the big convention. Anyway, here to talk about what's going on around the country, around the globe, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
So what do you think? His and her assault weapons?
Oh, why not?
Did you see the convention this weekend?
I would not watch. My weekend needed to be stress-free. I bet you watched it.
I watched some of it because you can only stand so much insanity. You know, I paid attention to some of it because, you know, you do want to see what craziness is coming out. Like, yes, put guns in your children's rooms.
Oh, I love that. I love that story.
And, you know, I guess, you know, part of me, and as I said earlier, part of me thinks the direction that they want the country to go is us to be so fear-laden that we have guns everywhere, rice and guns stashed everywhere. What do you think? Rice and guns everywhere.
No, I think that's right. I think that is the direction. And everybody has one, but that's not enough because the next person might have a bigger one, so you better get a bigger one.
Well, isn't that the male dilemma?
Yes, it always has been.
I mean, isn't that? I mean, you couldn't have put a more perfect analogy in that NRA convention right there. What? Yours is bigger than mine? Let's bomb them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it is.
And let me get a bigger one, and keep getting. Because you know, it's kind of like the Corvette thing. You know, my wife tells me that there's this stereotype of guys who drive Corvettes. And there's part of me that thinks, well, you know, people who have an arsenal, it's kind of got to be kind of that.
It is the same thing. And that's why it's so ludicrous that they're making, you know, pink bra holsters because the girls want to play in the boys' sandbox. It's like, you know, give it up. It's silly.
Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest. I like shooting things. I like blowing things up as much as the next person. But, you know, at the end of the day, do I want a culture saturated where everyone's walking around and the first person who smarts off gets shot? No. I grew up in that environment. I don't think the rest of society wants to grow up and lead their lives in the environment that I grew up in a housing project. Nobody wants that kind of, at least I don't want that for my kids. I think the NRA people, they do, and they love creating an environment of crisis.
It seems to be where they live. It seems to be their zeitgeist.
Yeah. Did you see this? There's this group that they want to do a 4th of July march on D.C. where they're
gonna, armed.
Yeah, we're gonna carry loaded weapons because we're gonna show them. And I've actually interviewed this Adam Kokesh, and I thought at one point he was a fairly lucid, rational guy. Now he's, you know, just taking this whole libertarian rant to the extreme. You're gonna walk on D.C. with loaded weapons, and to me, you know, as I said earlier, to me, I think you're just looking to incite something. You're looking to instigate, to cause a scene, so that they can profit from it. And to me, all of this is about profit. It has nothing to do with the Second Amendment. It has nothing to do with my right to have a gun. It has everything to do with creating little, you know, little stars and little right-wing crazy lunatic people. All about the money. I think it has nothing to do with the Second Amendment.
Oh, I think it's hugely about money. Hugely about money. I mean, I think for some people, for somebody like this guy, it may be. I mean, you know, it may be. He may, and maybe there would be a lawsuit and this and this, but he may want to march. And I read some of his stuff saying, you know, we're going to be peaceful, and if we are pushed, we will not push back. We will be peaceful. He's making it sound, trying to make it sound like a Martin Luther King march. It's the most ludicrous thing I ever heard.
Yeah, but the difference was is Martin Luther King didn't walk with a loaded firearm.
It was like the opposite. It's like opposite world.
So I know there's part of me that goes, okay, when the police come out with their tear gas, the cops didn't get shot? I mean, is this the world that they're trying to create? And I gotta tell you, you gotta wonder. All it takes is one, and you've got chaos.
Yes.
Sad stuff. Anyway, let's go around the globe. The sarin claims, the red line. What's going on in Syria?
Oh, my goodness. You know, earlier today, a former Swiss Attorney General who was a prosecutor for the international criminal thing for former Yugoslavia, she said that they have very strong evidence that sarin had been used in Syria by the rebels.
Oh, and where'd they get it?
Didn't say that.
Okay. So,
but now
I thought it was the other way around.
That's what we all thought. That's why it was a real man bites dog story. But later today, a statement has come out from the same UN war crimes investigators saying the independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Syrian Arab Republic wishes to clarify that it has not reached conclusive findings as to the use of chemical weapons in Syria by any parties in the conflict.
Uh-huh. So one side saying the rebels are doing it. One side said the government did it. The other side said the rebels do it. Now we don't know.
Well, since she works for the same organization.
Okay. And now where does that leave us?
Well, I think it leaves us that she spoke up too soon and said what she wasn't supposed to say about her report.
Uh-oh. So I kind of, the same kind of scenario we saw in Benghazi then.
Yeah, and it could be the rebels have used it. Now, the White House today, Jay Carney, the spokesman, said that he doesn't buy it. They do not buy that the rebels have access to chemical weapons. They don't buy that the rebels have used them. They think that Assad's gang have used them.
So where does that leave? Where does that put the red line then? What if the rebels did use it? Where does that move? Does that move the red line?
That's what's so interesting, isn't it? Because is it a movable red line? What do you do then? Because we're not going to go in and take out the rebels.
Yeah, that's... Wow.
It's so complicated.
And that's why I've always been a fan of just saying, I'm staying the hell out of it.
Yeah.
I go back to George Washington. Stay clear of foreign entanglements. We were founded on stay the hell out of other people's business.
This is one that's getting very, very complicated. You've had these Israeli airstrikes, and who knows who's going to retaliate against whom, at what point, and then who comes in.
But you know one thing that will happen? There's going to be profit made on this, because people are going to need guns.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, you know, I anytime you talk about war, I always go back to Smedley Butler's War is a Racket piece. It's all about the money.
Somebody always makes out like a bandit.
Somebody always profits from someone else's misery. And speaking of misery and profit and all of that, I look at this Texas fertilizer plant. I'm still waiting for someone to go to jail. I'd like to see some perp walk. I'd like to see some 15 lives ended, hundreds of people injured, a community in chaos, a community in shambles. I see a report that, you know, there were a lot of thefts, a lot of leaks. What other information you got?
Yeah, this is fascinating. Reuters very sensibly got hold of the 9/11 reports and the criminal offense reports and things like that through an open records request and has scoured them, crime reports, all this kind of stuff, over the past 12 years. Turns out, police responded to at least 11 reports of burglaries and 5 separate ammonia leaks over the past 12 years.
So people are stealing fertilizer and they've got tons of ammonia leaks.
Yeah, they're stealing all kinds of stuff. According to one 2002 crime report, a plant manager told police that intruders were stealing 4 to 5 gallons of anhydrous ammonia every 3 days.
Wow.
Now, that's stuff that you can use to cook methamphetamine.
Yeah. And it's nasty.
Yeah.
And why you would want it, I have no idea, other than, you know, a lot of cars use some of that for heating, for cooling, for air conditioning. Other than it just kills you.
Well, unless you're making meth.
Unless you're making meth, yeah. Well, so could that be why they had so much of this stuff on hand? You know, I read one report, something like 1,300 times the legal limit.
No, I think they just had a lot of stuff there and they didn't report it to anybody. I mean, there's a lot of things they didn't report stuff. They have massive security breaches. They were vulnerable to theft, leaks, fires, and explosions, according to chemical safety experts. They didn't report what they had. They had 540,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate,
nice.
54,000 pounds of anhydrous ammonia in 2012.
Nice. And, you know, hey, you know, look, Victoria, you know, we shouldn't worry about those companies. They'll police themselves. You know, people like you and I, we should have nothing. It's business. Deregulate. We need the jobs. It's good for the community. And here's a perfect example of a company that policed itself so well. And it's good for the community, right?
Right. And do you really think that Donald Adair, 83, and Wanda Adair, 78, who bought West Fertilizer in 2004, are going to jail?
Oh, no, 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 no. No, there'll be somebody will go to jail, I think, out of this. They've got to sacrifice someone at the altar of the free market. But it's not going to be those two. It'll be some low-level plant supervisor or someone who's going to fall on the dagger. And say we took care of it, and they'll brush it under the rug. And then the next one, because as I understand it, West wasn't even on any of the Homeland Security watch lists.
No, nobody, no, because their job is to report to DHS and say, oh, by the way, we've got all this stuff. Massive more than we're supposed to have, but we've got all this stuff, by the way. Well, they didn't do any of that.
Because you know what? They're watching out for themselves. You know, it's a good corporation. They're good people. They're a good corporate citizen, right? 93-foot crater in the ground there, which we're going to see later in June. As we take our RV trip across the country for the People's Tour for America, West is one of the places we're going to stop to see this big giant hole and talk to people in the community, see how things are going there since the explosion, kind of see what they think now of zoning regulations when you look at the fact that within 500 feet there was an elementary school. Just a thought.
Are you going anywhere jolly?
We're going to San Jose, you know, and now we can sing the song, because now I do know the way to San Jose.
I think you should go to Austin, too. That's jolly.
That's jolly? Well, we're going to the Bush Library. That's going to be very jolly. And
you will have a good time there.
I'm thinking of bringing my own Look and Find book to present to the people at the library.
I think you should do the interactive.
I'm going to do all of that. We're going to spend a day going through the Bush Library and all of that. And it'll give us something to talk about here on the program as we move across the country. I want to see if there are actually books there, you know, because maybe the painting of Bush's rear end. I don't know. Something.
It's going to be great.
Also, what's going on in Benghazi?
Well, this is getting complicated. This isn't looking very good for the administration. The hearing is Wednesday before the House Government Reform and Oversight Committee. Gregory Hicks, who was the number two career State Department official in Benghazi under slain Ambassador Chris Stevens, has got some written testimony that has already been released by the Republicans leading the committee. Obviously, they want to make as much out of this as they can. But his testimony is disturbing in that it does directly contradict things that the Obama administration has said, and and things that people have testified to. And if what he says is correct, it's really quite troubling. One of the things he said in his written testimony is that a second team of special ops officers were told not to fly to Benghazi on the evening of the attack. Now, they were on their way to the aircraft when this lieutenant colonel got a call from state saying they didn't have authority to go. And he says, I've never been so embarrassed in my life that a State Department officer has bigger bleeps than somebody in the military. Now, they wouldn't have been in time to save lives, but, of course, they didn't know that at the time.
Right. So where does this go, then? I mean, if that's the case, where do you think, where does it go?
Well, I think then the, I don't know what these other people are going to say, then I think the House of Government Reform Committee, this is Darrell Issa, he's not going to give up.
No.
He's going to want, and don't forget, there's also an investigation by the State Department of its own investigative report to see what they missed. I think you're going to see more hearings, and I think you're going to see administration officials called back, and if they don't come, subpoenaed.
Right. Well, I mean, at the end of this, it's not going away anyway. But, you know, even when you start finding things, of course I want it brought to light. Of course I want to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to do, like anybody else. And it's troubling to me when you have this, you know, I go back to the beginning. I think they were too quick to release any information. I think they were too quick to get out with anything. And I think it's biting them behind us. Now they're trying to cover their tracks. And
like I think that's what happened.
And like anything, it's the cover, it's the trying to cover your tracks that gets you into deep trouble.
Always.
You think that people would learn from Anthony Weiner? You think you would learn?
You'd think, even if they don't have a deeper sense of history than that, you'd think they'd learn from that.
Exactly. And finally, the online sales tax bill. Is the Senate moving on that?
They moved. 69-27. They passed it.
Amazon not happy.
Amazon wants it. eBay's not happy.
Oh, and somebody wasn't happy.
Yeah.
So what's that going to mean for small retailers? What's that going to mean for the brick and mortars?
Brick and mortars are very happy about this because they feel that they're on more of a level playing field now, that online retailers are going to have to pay tax too.
It always seemed interesting to me that you didn't have to pay tax online. And now I think it's a smart thing. I think it's the right thing because I think it is a more level playing field. And good. Well, what's the House going to do? Because I can't imagine there's much appetite for raising taxes on consumers.
Well, that's the way it's being looked at by several people in the House, that it's raising taxes on consumers. Whereas in fact, in most states, you're supposed to file these taxes anyway. Of course, most people don't. But you're supposed to file these taxes on your income tax.
I don't think most people know.
No, and that's the problem. Most people don't know. They don't know that they're supposed to do it. There are Republican supporters. There's a Republican from Arkansas who's the chief sponsor in the House who's saying it isn't an extra tax. You know, this already exists. This is something we've got to do. This is right. It's good for bricks and mortar business. This is something we need to do. So we're going to see. The chief argument against it in the House seems to be that the Senate bill's too complicated and it needs to be pared down. So maybe that's the route they'll take.
See, I could do a Herman Cain bill on this, and this is where Herman's probably right. Should be no longer than three pages in this, two, maybe three. Read it over dinner. Everything sold online is taxed, just like you would buy, like anything you buy or sell, you tax it. And I think it should be extended not just to products, but to stocks on Wall Street as well.
Oh yeah.
Just a thought. And finally, there's going to be, I guess, another repeal vote of Obamacare.
There is going to be a repeal vote, probably sometime in May, not quite clear, but Eric Cantor wrote a memo to House Republicans on Friday laying out the May agenda with all the fun things they intend to do, and that's one of them. He's promised them they can have a repeal vote, and they will. It looks like it's coming up in May, so they will vote to repeal it.
All right. Well, hey, you know, when you've got what are they, 0 for 35, 0 for 36 now?
Something like that.
What's one more?
Exactly.
There you go. Victoria Jones, I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things that go.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Earth, sky.
Earth's oceans might be acidifying today faster than they did in the last 300 million years, according to research by an international team of scientists.
Scientists say that too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is changing ocean chemistry and endangering key parts of the marine food chain.
What's happening is that as more and more carbon dioxide is added to the atmosphere, the oceans act like a sponge to draw the excess CO2 from the air. Carbon dioxide and water bind together to create carbonic acid, the same stuff that's used to make soft drinks bubbly.
It's a change in ocean chemistry, an increased acidity that endangers some ocean plankton and makes it harder for creatures like corals and mollusks to build reefs and shells.
The paper authors reviewed hundreds of paleo-oceanographic studies and found evidence for only one period in the past 300 million years when the oceans changed as fast as today. That was about 56 million years ago, after a mysterious surge of carbon into the atmosphere.
But in the last 100 years, rising carbon dioxide from human activities has acidified the ocean at least 10 times faster than 56 million years ago, say the researchers.
Learn more about ocean acidification. Come to our website, earthsky.org, and search for it. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Also, follow us on Twitter. Go to Facebook. You know, all of that stuff. We do it all. I have a wonderful producer who does all of that stuff. Hey, just top of the line. Good stuff. Anyway, going back to the big convention, some of my favorite parts. Beyond the pink bras with the gun holster. Beyond the comment by Wayne LaPierre. Who asked, you know, how many Bostonians wish they had a gun 2 weeks ago? Beyond that, I liked the target. They have targets that look like President Obama. And when you shoot it, it bleeds. Yeah, I mean, Zombie Industries evidently has made this product. Because it looks like the president. Life-size targets, because, you need the practice, right? You need to have one for Christmas, for instance, that bleeds, a bleeding target. And, of course, my favorite, the Mayor Bloomberg image made to look like a Nazi during the Glenn Beck speech. So you throw all that together, the pink bra holsters and the his and her assault weapons, and the, don't bet you those Boston people wish they had assault weapons. Yeah, because that would have been a great scene, wouldn't it? Since nobody knew who did it, and this is the part that gets me, nobody knew who did that. So wouldn't it have been a scene where people pull out their assault weapons and just start shooting randomly? Just a question. Also, gotta love the Christmas is coming, the bleeding target. Who could not want, who wouldn't want a bleeding target? Is it me, or is it just things have really gotten strange? Or, as I said, it's about the money. It's about how much we can get people all lathered up and how much we can get them all lathered up and worked up so that they'll part with a few bucks. Just amazing stuff. Anyway, in the coming days and weeks, we're going to be putting together our bus tour as we go across the country. And I'm looking forward to the opportunity to get out and meet a bunch of people, a bunch of our listeners from across the country who listen to the program. I think that'll be exciting and entertaining. Also going to be bringing someone on to help for this tour. Pat LaMarche is going to be here on Wednesday to sit in with me, and on Thursday she's going to take over for a day. I'm looking forward to that. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, infamous.